We'd like to call this meeting to order. We'd like to welcome you to the Central Region Regional Advisory Committee meeting. Before we get started, we'd like to start over here on my right, and we'll have the board members introduce themselves and state who they're representing.
I'm Mike Gates. I'm the field manager in Fillmore at the BLM.
George Holmes, agriculture.
Dave Price, elected officials.
Matt Clark, sportsman.
Richard Hanson, at-large.
Gary Nielsen, sportsman.
Dan Potts, non-consumptive.
Tim Fair, at-large.
Carl Hurst, sportsman rep.
Chris Schmitz, non-consumptive.
Thank you. We'd also like to recognize the assistant director, Mike Canning, who is with us tonight. Before we get started, I want to go over just a little bit of the procedure with regarding RAC meetings. I know many of you have been to them, but it never hurts to review. It's a public forum where you're allowed to express your opinions and ideas, and we're going to encourage you to do that. The RAC will consider your ideas and opinions, and then we will report them to the Wildlife Board. We all have our own ideas about what's best, and most of us approach our ideas and our with the things with quite a bit of emotion and quite a bit of passion. It's why we're here, and that's the reason that we're involved, is to try and make a difference. We encourage you to express your opinions, but we also encourage you to respect the opinions of those with opposing view. And please keep your emotions in check during your presentations and while other people are speaking. On the table just outside the door there was a agenda. Hopefully you got that. Also, if you wish to make participate in the process or make a comment, we need to have you fill out a comment card. What will happen is we'll have a presentation made by the division, and that will take anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes. That will just give us some background and the division's proposal. At the end of that presentation, I'll ask the RAC members if there are any questions about the division's position or about the presentation itself. Okay, after we get through the questions the RAC members might have, they'll ask the audience if for points of clarification or questions they have. And this is not a time to make comments or offer your opinion, but to simply ask questions. I will need you to help me when you come to the mic, and we'll invite you to the mic for those questions to state your name, who you represent, if you're representing an organization or if you're just representing yourself. Anyway, keep your comments short. Once all the members in the audience have had a chance to ask their question, the question period will be closed. And at that point, we'll go to the public comment period, at which time I will go through these cards and I will invite you to the microphone to offer your opinion or your comments or your suggestions. When you do come up, please state your name. Also state who you're speaking for if you're speaking for a group. If you're speaking for yourself, you will have 3 minutes to address the board. If you're speaking for an organization, you will have a maximum of 5 minutes. I strongly urge you, those of you who are making comments, to listen carefully to the other comments that are made. There's a lot of us, you know, where it's almost like we're on the same page, and we could save a lot of time, you know, if you just agree with something that's already been said rather than re-saying it. Also, I need one more favor from you. As you fill out these cards, fill them out legibly so we can actually give credit where credit's due on the comments and the participation. Okay, our first item of business is approval of the agenda in the minutes. You've had a chance to see the agenda, and you've had a chance to read last week's minutes. Is there any additions or corrections that need to be made? I'll entertain a motion to accept the minutes in the new agenda. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Okay. Our first item is within the informational. We'll be having a regional or wildlife meeting update, and that'll be by Richard Hanson, who is the vice chair. He attended wildlife board meeting in the last round, and we'll be hearing from him.
Okay, I'll just go over the action items. Won't get too detailed about it, just so you have this information, all of you. There was a motion that they approved the goat management plan for Mount Dutton with the augmentation up to 125 goats, and have the division meet annually with an advisory group to address concerns. that motion was passed unanimously. The next motion that was made concerning goats was that they moved to accept the goat management plan for the LaSalle with the transplant up to 200 goats and have the division meet annually with an advisory group to address concerns. That actually passed 4-2. I might mention that there was a lot of discussion about this, and it went on for a long time. And I guess John will talk, maybe he'll talk about what's happening there. There was also a motion made to postpone transplants until monitoring is established and keep the goats at a density of 1.8 animals per square mile, and that motion failed 2-4. There was a cougar recommendation that passed 5-1 that accept the cougar recommendations as presented with the requirement that the division reopen the management plan, provide a simplified proposal that incorporates unit by unit next year. There's also a lot of discussion concerning that because the current plan is really complicated, to say the least. And so next year they're going to propose a plan that will hopefully simplify that for everyone. There was a motion to accept the fur bear and bobcat harvest recommendations that passed unanimously. There was a proposal to accept the waterfowl guidebook and rule 5657-09 is presented with the youth hunt start date of September 21st, 2013. That was passed unanimously. There was a new rule concerning military installations and hunting. There was a motion made to accept the military installation permit program presented by the division, and that passed unanimously. There was also a proposed fee schedule for the fiscal year 2015. It was made that they accept that new fee schedule as presented, and that passed unanimously also. I think that has to be approved by the legislature. There was a brine shrimp rule amendment that passed unanimously. Also, there was a rule that moved to approve RS-657-60 AIS rule amendment as presented by the division. That also passed unanimously. There was a convention permit allocation, a motion that was made, presented, of course, is presented by the division, and it passed with one abstention, and that was passed unanimously other than that, and they accepted that. There's a CRC recommendation that we approved both the CRC recommendation and presented, and that passed unanimously. So major items that were taken took place that time.
All right, thank you, Richard. Before we go any further, we appreciate the board members that have made an effort to be here. I have two that have asked to be excused, Sarah Flinders with the Forest Service and Larry Fitzgerald with Agriculture. Also, our board member Chris Marble has had a work emergency, and he's going to try and be here late, so we'll watch for him to come in and occupy that chair. Okay, our next item will be a regional update, and that'll be from the regional supervisor, John Fairchild.
Thanks. I'll go through by section and give an update from our last meeting. But before I do, I need to let you know that we took a little beating in the social media for never holding a meeting up here in the Salt Lake office, and something's telling me by your attendance tonight that you'd support another aquatics meeting next year, so you can probably count on that. I appreciate everybody that has shown up tonight, and I know that it's a little tough to make the trip down to Springville, so mixing it up a little bit, I think, will give you a better opportunity to be involved, and that's what this is all about. So thank you. Some of you participated in a restoration project the first phase of a restoration project in Mill Creek this last week, and we appreciate your support. The upper third of that drainage was treated with rotenone, and it went very successfully. And Of course, the goal is to restore the native cutthroat, the Bonneville cutthroat trout, to that drainage. And so we're looking forward to that. It's about a three-year program, almost four, really, when you map it out. But by doing it in phases, we maintain some fishing opportunities in the drainage, and which is important. You know, we don't want to be too disruptive. And it allows us to learn from anything that we make some adjustments as we learn from each treatment. So our guys did a great job, and they were supported by a lot of TU members and other volunteers, so we appreciate that. Our aquatic section has been busy this last year and wrapped up just recently a fisheries management plan for Strawberry. We won't be presenting that tonight, but you can expect that in a future RAC meeting. And Yuba will be discussed tonight, so we're making progress there, and I think that gives us a great opportunity to get the feedback that we need in order to manage those fisheries in a way that the public would like, and within the constraints, the biological constraints of those waters. Our native aquatics group is working with our heavy equipment crews and doing some stream restoration work in Main Creek. There we're looking again at a native cutthroat trout reintroduction someday, improving habitat for leatherside chub. But it starts with improving the habitat, and that drainage has suffered pretty much from historic practices, and we're trying to make some improvements there. There'll be some opportunities, many opportunities, in October to participate with division personnel doing gill netting. We'll be gill netting at Deer Creek, Strawberry, and Jordanelle. Also Yuba, did you say? Also Yuba. And also electrofishing in Diamond Fork and Sixth Water. So some monitoring that's going on that you're welcome to participate. Just get a hold of Mike Slater and Don Wiley and find out more about it. We do have a new employee that is filling Jordan Nielsen's position. Jared Randall is our Blue Ribbon Fisheries biologist, and he'll be working with Don Wiley and Mike. In our wildlife section, we will be releasing quite a few pheasants in ahead of the pheasant hunt this year, and the day-old chick program is going to add to a lot of birds that were raised and paid for by some sportsman groups and the division. Just a quick update on that goat transplant. We did. They moved. They met their targets, I believe, in all the areas. They moved 21 goats, I believe, to the LaSalle's, 20 to the Dutton, and they did move 10 to the Nebo, and we plan to move another 10 in October. So that went off very well. We're working with Highland City on a pilot program, deer control within the city limits. Division has issued a certificate of registration that allows Highland City to manage deer as if they were the Division of Wildlife Resources. Basically, they assume responsibility for selecting the expert shooters. They're working through a local archery retail outlet, and that should begin fairly soon. There's probably a dozen shooters that are going to be involved. They have to be certified by Humphreys Archery, who's kind of working this for Highland City. And they hope to take, in the two-year period, 200 deer. And so they're looking to harvest 100. The meat will be processed and packaged and made available to those who need it. Youth waterfowl hunt will be this Saturday, along with a youth chucker hunt. And I don't know, we're right in the middle of the hunt, so it's the best time of year if you're upland game bird hunter or big game hunter. And waterfowl coming up. Outreach. Our Hunter Ed Plus pilot program, it's a program where we take Hunter Ed graduates and give them NRA, hook them up with NRA certified shotgun shooting instructors, give them a training program, increase their proficiency and their understanding of all the safety and fundamentals. They will, after that course, they're eligible for a mentored hunt at a local commercial hunting area, and we probably have 150. I won't say kids. You know, the demographics are all over the board. We have 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 8-year-olds. They all show up, and they all show up with the same enthusiasm because they've never done it before. And it's a real opportunity to provide a pathway for Hunter Ed graduates to become hunters and to enjoy the shooting sports. Raptor Watch Day and the Kokanee Festival this Saturday up at Strawberry. Raptor Watch is at Squaw Peak. And we just finished the state fair where hundreds of thousands of people got to visit with us. It's always entertaining. I sign up every year just to be entertained. And also to pass out some information. Our habitat section, we have several projects going there. Strawberry, we're still doing some work around Sage Creek, sagebrush thinning. We got some chaining projects, Dairy Fork, also Bear Creek, CWMU, and Sand Peak County. We'll be putting together a rehab project, the Patch Fire on the south end of the Stansberries. Then a law enforcement case that we're working on. It's a spike bull area, so the big bull elk taken on Traverse Ridge was taken at the wrong time by the wrong person, so they're going to be working on that. And they'll also be planning their winter range patrols coming up soon. That's about it. Archery hunt was pretty wet for anyone that was out there.
I have a question.
Shoot.
Last night on the news, I saw a story about an elk goring.
Yeah.
Can you give us some details of that?
I'm sure
it was portrayed as an elk goring a hunter to death, but is that the truth? Can you shed some light on that?
He could have died had the Division of Wildlife Resources personnel not just concluded the goat transplant and been in the area. He had a punctured lung, and he walked several miles back from where he was watching sheep. And just a fortuitous, meeting with Division of Wildlife Resources officers. One of them just happened to be an EMT, so they got him packaged up, and the helicopter came in, took him off. He most likely would not have made it, had they not been. Ken,
John, on your pheasant deal last year. We were allowed to plant them around Salina and all the way out to Delta on the wildlife management areas. Is that going to change to new wildlife management areas this year, or is it still going to be those same ones? Like, are we going to bring them up into Utah County, into the wildlife management areas?
I'm not sure of all the areas yet, but I know that they're going to be distributed among wildlife management areas in both regions. We will have quite a few. A lot of ours will probably go out on the Utah Lake Wetland Preserve. That's some of the best habitat. Also, the Nephi Game Farm, they'll get some birds. Fountain Green will get some birds. Other areas that we've got in mind, but I'm not sure. Sure. But they will be distributed among WMAs among the regions. A lot more birds than last year.
All right, thank you, John. Our first item tonight is an action item. It's a fishing guidebook rule, R657-13, and we have Drew Cushing, who's going to make the presentation. He's the aquatic program coordinator. Drew.
Okay. My name is actually Paul Birdsey. I'm the other half of this duo. I'm the cold water sport fish coordinator with the division, and it's, I echo John's thanks for the members of the public to come out here tonight. It's nice not having more people in the audience with brown uniforms on than actually members of the public. So it's appreciate you coming out. Thank you also, RAC, for the opportunity to make this presentation. Let's see if I can figure out how to make this work. Okay, the aquatic section puts a lot of effort into trying to listen to the public and what they want. We do this through a variety of methods. We meet with angler groups throughout the year. We talk with people when we're out on surveys. But one of our major ways of gathering information is to conduct an online survey of anglers. This year was from May 10th to June 10th. And as part of that, we asked 8 questions regarding possible regulation changes and 1 question on the management direction at Schofield Reservoir. There was also space provided for general comments. This is just a free form comment. Tell us what you like, what you don't like, what you'd like to see changed. A total of about 1,100 people participated in the survey this year. And that's in addition to the open houses that we held in every region and our meetings with the Anglers Coalition every month, Blue Ribbon Fisheries Advisory Council pretty much every month, and other efforts. One of the questions that we asked this year was regarding a change in a possession limit. This was an item that we were directed to look into by the Wildlife Board last November. And currently, the state of Utah has a 1-day possession limit, or 1-day daily limit, which is also your possession limit. Technically, you cannot possess more than 1 day's worth of fish, whether it be in your camp, in your freezer, wherever. What we have suggested is looking at a 2-day possession limit, and what we're really trying to accomplish with this is that as years have gone by, gas prices have increased, etc., it's becoming more and more difficult for people to justify going to these more distant waters from the Wasatch Front for a single day's limit. So we would like to encourage people to go to these waters like Starvation, Pelican, etc., with the idea that they could go out there, camp for a couple days, and keep a couple of days worth of limit. Their daily limit would still be the same, but they get to keep two limits. Based on our discussions with our aquatics managers, members of the public, et cetera, we came up with 3 alternatives. And we asked that on the survey, and these are the results from that survey. The first alternative was a 2-day possession limit for all species. We also had a 2-day possession limit for warm and cool water species only, and then we also included a no change in the possession limit. You look at this, you'll see that there was a slight majority wanted a 2-day possession limit for all species, less so for the 2-day possession limit on warm and cool water species, and fully 36% of the people wanted no change in the possession limit whatsoever. You can interpret this information a variety of different ways. The way we've chosen to interpret it is that based on the response of the upper two alternatives combined, we're saying that people want some kind of change. So what we're offering as a recommendation is that in addition to 1 legal daily limit of unprocessed fish, that is fish that are freshly caught, you haven't done anything with, a person may possess 1 additional limit of processed fish. And processing in this case includes gutting, filleting, doing whatever of fish that you have caught a previous day. And that you have to be within the legal limit of fish species and a water body where the angler is fishing on that day. The only exceptions to this rule are Strawberry Reservoir and Flaming Gorge, where you may have only 1 daily possession or 1 daily limit in your possession. And this is because, for 2 reasons for Strawberry. First of all, Strawberry is very highly used. Some anecdotal evidence from 2012 indicates that we have about a 30% exploitation rate on our rainbow trout at Strawberry Reservoir. This is very high. We're concerned that having a 2-day possession limit may impact that fishery. And we also have a very active angler group, the Strawberry Anglers Association, that was concerned about this and voted to recommend that we do not adopt it there at Strawberry. Flaming Gorge, we manage that in cooperation with Wyoming Game and Fish. They have a two-year biennial proclamation cycle, which they just started this first year. They have a one-day possession limit there. We would like to, as much as possible, sync with their rule. They have suggested that they're going to move forward with a two-day possession limit in 2015. We will probably be coming back at that time for, if they are able to move forward with that, that we would come back at that time with a recommendation, the same on Flaming Gorge. Underwater spear fishing. Again, the Wildlife Board directed us in last November to review this rule with an idea of providing more opportunity for spear fishermen. We put together a large group of people that we met with in January. There was about 20 of us or so when we first started. That group was then whittled down to a reasonable number of, I believe it was three or four representatives of the hook and line anglers and three or four representatives of the spear fishermen. I would like to thank Quinn Woodmansee, Terry Reist, George Sommer, and a few others that were very active in this discussion and helped us come up with this proposal. Now, the final proposal that we'll present here in a moment is a compromise of widely different viewpoints. And these people are very passionate. They also happen to be polar opposites. When we walked away from there, absolutely no one got everything that they were asking for. But that is the nature of compromise. And we are very grateful that they were willing to set aside some of those things and work to come together with the proposal that we have here. We put this proposal out on the online survey. It was supported by about 71% of the respondents. So here's the proposal. We're proposing increasing the length of the spear fishing season from January 1st to December 31st. Those waters listed on the left, the ones in yellow, are new. They have not previously allowed spear fishing. They would be open that year round. The ones on the right, again, the ones in yellow, are new. They would be closed to black bass, that is the take of largemouth and smallmouth, from April 1st to the 4th Saturday in June. And this is to protect the spawning fish, which the bass anglers were very concerned about. In addition to those changes, we also removed, the group elected to remove Jordanelle Reservoir, which is currently allowed for spear fishing, because of some concerns with the smallmouth population there. And Lost Creek Reservoir, because it was changed in 2012 to a slot limit and actually should have been removed from spear fishing at that time, but was left on through an oversight. And just as a reminder to people, we just want to remind people that carp may be taken in any water statewide that has an open fishing season. Okay, the second biggest issue that we brought before the public was that the Wildlife Board has had the ability to recommend catch and kill regulations on those fish that were mostly illegally introduced into waters. However, there was a glitch there that those fish had to be used according to the state code in a beneficial manner, which basically said that they had to be taken home and consumed. In the 2013 legislative session, we went to the legislature, asked them to change that so that the Wildlife Board could designate waters and species where those fish could be disposed of, or as previously termed, wasted. We were also asked by the RACS and Wildlife Board last year to come up with a list of how we would recommend people dispose of those fish. and you can see those five recommendations there. They can dispose them in the water where the fish is caught, buried on the shoreline, fish cleaning station, the angler's place of residence, or another location where disposal is authorized by law. So, these are the ones that we're recommending for the disposal allowance. All water statewide to common carp. In Blue Lake, the tilapia, Deer Creek Reservoir, white bass and black bullhead, Flaming Gorge Reservoir Burbot, Grantsville Reservoir Smallmouth Bass, Lake Powell Striped Bass, Red Fleet Reservoir Walleye, and Utah Lake Northern Pike. All of these, except for Lake Powell, currently have a catch and kill regulation on those fish, but what we have at Lake Powell is we have a cyclic population of striped bass. They tend to overrun their food source. They get really skinny. We have had a no limit there for a number of years, but they're not necessarily good table fare. But we would still like people to remove them rather than to just release them. So in addition to that, we're proposing adding the Green River, Colorado River, and San Juan Rivers, and the following tributaries, which I won't go read through here, for the species at the bottom, for burbot, northern pike, smallmouth bass, and walleye. And this is to assist primarily with the endangered fish program that is currently going on in those locations. So, in addition to the disposal, there are a couple of catch and kill regulations that we're proposing. It's somewhat of a misnomer on this slide that we're not proposing a catch and kill on channel catfish in the Green, Colorado, and San Juan Rivers. It will be a no limit, however. And then on the burbot, northern pike, smallmouth bass, or walleye, that would be a catch and kill regulation on those species. We propose that to the public, and about 80% of the respondents were in favor of that. In addition to that, I said catch and kill on the main stems, we would also have the same regulation on the tributaries. Currently, there is kind of a problem there that if you're fishing on the main stem of the Green River, there is no limit on channel catfish. However, if you happen to be fishing at the confluence of Range Creek and you turn slightly to the right, you now have a 10 fish limit. So what we're proposing is those tributaries are the same regulation. It would not include, however, those reservoirs that we are currently managing for those species, such as Starvation Reservoir, would continue to have the regulation in place that it currently does. Okay, just more tributaries. Okay, into the regional recommendations. Brian Head Pond in Iron County. They'd like to manage this as a community fishery and therefore impose the two fish limit currently in place for all community fisheries statewide. We had a number of waters that previously were prohibited from motorboat use in the southern region. Those were removed from our proclamation a few years ago when we tried to simplify the regulation. Turn that list over to state parks. They did not necessarily keep up with that, so there was confusion within the angling public. We want to bring it back into our proclamation to make sure that it's clear. So it's not really a change other than a housekeeping kind of thing. There's Aspen Mirror Lake in Kane County, Ducks Creek Springs Lake, Kane County, and Pine Valley Reservoir in Washington County, where you cannot fish from a boat or float tube. And then there's several waters here that you can not fish with a boat with a motor of any kind. So that's Anderson Meadow Reservoir, Barney Lake, Boulder Mountain Lakes, except for the three that are listed there, and Little Reservoir in Beaver County. One more change in the southern region. Currently, chumming is allowed only in Lake Powell in this state, and it's only with anchovies. Well, it's, however, you can fish with any other kind of bait as long as you have it attached to a hook in Lake Powell. So what we thought was practical was that if you can fish with sucker meat in Lake Powell, you should be able to chum with sucker meat in Lake Powell. So we're just recommending that all legal baits may be used as chum at Lake Powell. In our northeast region, Current Creek is a small stream. It doesn't get much pressure. It currently has a restrictive limit of 2 fish. They would like to increase the limit, see whether it attracts a few more anglers there. It also, you know, just standardizes it, so it's one less special regulation in the proclamation. Red Fleet Reservoir in Uinta County, we currently have no limit for walleye there. We'd like to change that to a no limit with a catch and kill. We were reluctant to do that before simply because there is also a mercury advisory on those fish in Red Fleet Reservoir, and we didn't think it was in the public health's best interest if we required them to eat those fish when the Department of Health was telling them that they shouldn't be. In the central region, Wasatch Mountain State Park, again, it has been managed more or less as a community fishery. This is just to firm that up and place that as a 2 fish limit. Yuba Reservoir, as John mentioned earlier, there's been a group working for about a year to put together a management plan, which I think Mike is going to talk about more in a little bit. One of the recommendations coming out of that is 20 northern pike, only 1 northern pike over 36 inches. And this is an attempt to thin down the abundant northern pike in there and while maintaining some type of trophy aspect. Over 80% of the people in the survey supported that question. Northern Region Lost Creek Reservoir, again, an oversight as a result of the change to the slot limit in 2012. On our other waters that have that slot limit, such as Strawberry, Schofield, and Panguitch, anglers may not fillet the trout nor remove their heads or tails while they're in field or in transit. This is to allow a better law enforcement, and we just want to bring Lost Creek into compliance with those other waters. State Line Reservoir in Summit County, we had a pretty viable kokanee fishery there at one time. They seem to have disappeared. Then, through magic, they came back. We're recommending that the reservoir be closed to the possession of any kokanee salmon with red color from August 15th through 6 a.m. on the last Saturday of September, and over 90% support on the survey. Willard Bay Reservoir and Inlet Channel. Willard Bay has gizzard shad present in it. You can use commercially prepared gizzard shad that is available from Sportsman's Warehouse and other commercial vendors in every water in the state as bait except for Willard Bay. So what we want to do is just allow those people that are fishing in Willard Bay to use gizzard shad, provided that they're commercially prepared. We do not want people capturing gizzard shad and using them fresh or, heaven forbid, live, and certainly not transporting them anywhere else. We have several small waters where, or actually Weber River's not that small, where we have native species concerns. Currently, we allow the harvest of non-game fish for bait in those waters. We want to restrict that to where carp are the only non-game fish that can be taken, because we do have bluehead suckers and other native fish in those waters, which we are concerned about. Southeast region, Electric Lake, this is a new kokanee fishery. We do not actually expect to see any kokanee there for about 3 years. However, we just want to get ahead of the curve here and close it to the possession of kokanee with any red color, same as State Line Reservoir, and again, over 90% support. And the same thing with the tributaries to Electric Lake, and again, over 90% support. snagging. We have some difficulty in a couple of our waters with snagging, and part of that is due to the fact that we have an unclear definition of exactly what snagging is. So we are proposing the following rule and definition, where it says, in the rule, it is unlawful to intentionally snag or attempt to snag any fish. Fish hooked anywhere other than the mouth must be released immediately. And in the definition, a snag means to hook a fish elsewhere than in the mouth. The only exception to this rule is at Bear Lake for Bonneville, Cisco. Thank you. We will also have a presentation here in a minute about some results from that Schofield survey, so I won't go into any more detail on that right now. With that, I'd be happy to address any questions.
Members of the RAC, you have any questions or points of clarification?
Paul, I have a question. Why are you closing Jordan L to spearfishing? I mean, to me it seems like, you know, those guys, they fall under the same limits as anyone else. What is the danger? What is the concern about a spear fisherman at Jordan L?
There's just a concern by the bass anglers. They were seeing a reduction in the size of smallmouth bass over the last 4 or 5 years. They were concerned that the reason for that reduction in size was because those large fish were being harvested, whether it be by spear fishermen or by other anglers. We are currently doing work to address exactly what is going on at Jordan L Reservoir, but just in terms of the members of the public that participated in the process felt strongly that Jordan L needed to be taken off the list, and so we're going with the public recommendation on this.
Do you have any idea how many spear fishermen there are in the state?
In talking with the spear fishermen, they suggest that there's somewhere between 100 and 200 spear fishermen. We don't have a spear fishing license per se, so we don't know exactly. What I can say is that doing this professionally for almost 35 years now, I have talked with exactly one spear fisherman in the field, and that was actually while I was recreationally fishing at Deer Creek this past spring. There's not a lot of them, but it's something that is a very emotional topic, and so therefore we are trying to find a compromise there where everybody can feel, you know, like they're walking away at least somewhat of a winner here. And it's been a long, hard process. I won't deny it. It's been a long, hard process. There's a lot of emotion on both sides of this issue. People are very passionate about it. And again, I thank the people that did come together and develop this compromise.
Thank you.
Just maybe a question on clarification. On that Lost Creek Reservoir, it says that they're not able to fillet trout or salmon.
Right.
What if they eat it there?
That, of course, would not hold, but it's basically in transit is the last part of that, so it is they can't basically leave the reservoir with that fish having been filleted or the head or tail.
But they could.
They could theoretically have a shore lunch.
Okay.
And we don't have a problem
okay.
with that.
That's all.
Go ahead, Timothy.
On the separate limit for not 2 day limit on strawberry, they really expect that there's going to be overfishing strawberry if you allow a 2 day limit, because that's a hike for a lot of people to get there.
The 2 day possession limit, first thing I want to clarify, is only if you're camping overnight and you happen to stay there for a couple of days. The majority of people that visit Strawberry, Jordan L, waters that are close to Wasatch Front go for a day and they come home. So their limit doesn't change one way or the other. However, having said that, at the peak of fishing pressure in Strawberry Reservoir 7-8 years ago, we were getting about 1.3 million angler hours there. Even just a small percentage may in fact tip that balance the wrong way with regards to strawberry. So what we have committed to do here is to kind of ease into this, look at some of the other waters that are high-use waters, see if there's any impact there, and then move towards inclusion with perhaps strawberry in the future, or maybe not. It really depends.
Danny.
Yeah, I was a bit surprised that you didn't mention the on that same two-day possession limit, you didn't mention out-of-staters. You know, they bring in a heck of a lot of spinoff money, and if, you know, being, you know, and they're stuck. You know, I mean, you know, they've come all this way from Colorado or, you know, wherever to fish, let's say it's strawberry, but it could be starvation or anywhere else. You know, that might be an incentive to bring new money into the state.
It certainly may be. And, you know, I didn't mention out-of-staters just simply because I forgot. And we don't deal with those foreigners anyway, you know, from Colorado and Wyoming. But, no, actually what we did recently discover is that we always thought that out-of-state anglers comprise around 10% of our angling public, when in fact it's closer to 25%. And Danny's absolutely right. That represents a huge financial boon for the state, and this may help us attract a few more.
Are there any other questions from the RAC? Okay, we'll open it up to members of the audience. If you have any questions or points of clarification, we'll need you to step to the mic and state your name and who you're representing. You have a question?
I do. Yeah.
I don't answer questions from you.
My name is Paul Cowley. I'm the Natural Resources and Planning Staff Officer on the Uinta Wasatch Cache National Forest. Paul, one of the questions I have for you is, how much of a risk do you think we pose where people may pick up their two fish and strawberry and then run down to Current Creek to capture two more?
For the possession limit?
For the possession of four. Is that a risk?
Again, you have a daily limit, so it technically they could catch two fish at Strawberry, go to Current Creek, catch two more fish, which they would then have four fish in their possession, which they're entitled to do. If they then chose to camp overnight at Current Creek, they could keep four more fish the following day from Current Creek, and they're perfectly legal in doing so. It's going to happen, but the percentage of that I really can't answer, and I really don't see a significant impact from that.
Are there any other? Yes, go ahead.
Yep.
Come to the mic, please.
Up to the mic. Probably a small enough room. Okay, I kind of got two questions to ask. Number one, if you're going to add value to the license if you add this extra fish onto the limit. In other words, when I go in to buy a license now, I look at it and go, I'm just not getting four fish. I got the possibility of getting eight fish.
In a two-day trip.
Right. So it adds a perceived value. If that bumps the license purchasing up, now you go from 450,000 anglers purchasing license and you add another 30,000 to 50,000 anglers on top of it. I don't know, is there any kind of built-in for that, what the angler perceives as a value, and you may increase your anglers? Do you want to increase anglers or do you want to stay the same?
There's goals here of increasing the number of licenses that we sell. Obviously, about 60% of our funding for the division comes from license sales, so selling more. If that happens, however, it may be necessary on some waters to reduce the limit in order to, if there's an impact from more people fishing.
But that would only be on individual waters, not statewide. You'd still stick with the...
Very likely.
Okay. And then the second question, which is kind of minuscule, but I got to ask it anyway. Angler Day, Is that midnight to midnight, or is that 24 hours after I caught my last fourth fish?
It's that midnight to midnight. It's that September 17th is not the same as September 18th.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering, because we go on some moonlight fly fishing trips. So if we get to the lake on a moonlight night at 11 o'clock, we can catch four fish up to 12, and then four fish after and be back 3 hours later with a full 8-fish limit.
I have no idea how to answer that. I think you would have to have a friendly conservation officer at that point in time.
Would you state your name, please?
Grant, I'll tell you, Tom.
Okay, did you get that? Yes.
My name's Clifford Sackett, and what I'm wondering about is the snagging law. Now, what I understand, or the proposal or whatever, I do a lot of bass fishing, mainly that's what I like doing, but a lot of times we're throwing top water, and we will catch fish that come up and hit the lure, but we may hook them around the cheek and places like that. And then we got to turn them loose. We turn them loose anyway, but a lot of people do keep them. And the snagging is basically during the spawn of the walleye and some of the other fish like that. Is there a way of kind of tweaking that a little bit so that it only covers the spawning of the fish?
That would be incredibly difficult to write into a rule and to enforce. The key word in that snagging rule is that you have to intentionally be doing that. So there, you can foul hook a fish. My one and only greatest catch at Utah Lake was I foul hooked a carp right in the tail. But gave a great fight, especially on an ultralight rod. But nonetheless, that was a foul hook. It was unintentional. That fish was released. There's some, you know, leeway discretion. We say in the mouth, there's going to be some leeway. It's going to be a discretionary thing based on the officer's interpretation. One caught in the back, that's a foul hook. Okay. You release that one. You catch it in the head on the outside of the mouth, that sounds like an officer discretion thing to me.
Yes.
Quick question on Barry Ramosh. With respect to the 2 days limit, are you going to provide definitions for what is considered a processed fish?
Yes, that was in an earlier rack. That was certainly a discussion point because we had it in our mind that we knew what processed fish when we put the presentation together. Unfortunately, that didn't get communicated effectively to the public as part of this presentation. So we will have a definition on what processed fish is.
Excellent. Otherwise, I would see it being a disaster. But with those definitions, I think that would be excellent. Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Bob Dibley, Trout Unlimited, and the Blue Ribbon. I had a question on the 2-day catch. Just like with all the other eggs, how are they going to have to prove that they were there for 2 days? I mean, it'd be easy to say, I slept in my car overnight. And
that's been a point of discussion with our law enforcement officers throughout the course of this consideration of this regulation. Is how do you determine whether that fish was caught today or caught yesterday? The law enforcement response from the chief on down has been that they will have to work that case exactly like they do every other over limit, and it's up to them to prove whether you caught that fish the day before or not. However they choose to do that is entirely, how they do their jobs.
But it has been taken into, you know,
it has. We've discussed that many, many times with Tony Woods, chief, Rick Olson, the captain, the regional lieutenants, et cetera.
Are there any other questions from the audience? Okay, we'll close the question period, points of clarification, and I have a list of people who have stated desire to make their opinions and ideas known. We'll start with...
Mr. Chairman, before I sit down, I just want to let the board know that if during the course of the comments, if there's some other information that you feel that you'd like from the division as part of this process, please feel free to call on myself or Drew, so we'll be happy to help you out.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. We'll first hear from Paul Calley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the items that, as we looked at this, Paul Calley, by the way, went to Wasatch Cache National Forest. One of the items that was a concern to us as we looked at the catch and kill provision is the burying of fish along the shoreline of waters where the fish were caught. With some of our high recreation waters, this would create a real nuisance to the other general recreating public. And so we would recommend that the board remove that, or sorry, the central rack, recommend to the board that they remove that item from that list of possible disposal areas.
Okay. Thank you very much. Clifford Sackett.
Thank you. I passed out papers. I hope everybody got one or can look at it. But anyway, a lot of the bass fishermen, since regulations are changed, nobody likes catching little fish, especially bass. And everybody says that you got to keep, you know, you should keep some in order to keep the fishery viable. Well, when Jordanelle had a lot of big fish in it, because the regulations was nothing over 12 inches, we didn't have an overabundance of little fish in it because the bigger fish ate a lot of them. And that's what happens in a lot of the ecosystems. Right now it's so far out of balance until I don't know what it would take to get it back in balance for sure. But if we could get a slot limit on the bass, I think it would help in a great deal. And many other states have slot limits to curb the same thing that's happening here. Texas, which is a well-known state for bass, some of their major lakes all have slot limits. Most of their slot limits is from 16 to 24 inches on the bass. And California has slot limits. Florida even has slot limits on bass on certain lakes. And it's proven that it does help. Look at Strawberry and the trout. The slot limit helps up there. Once they get grown or bigger fish, it really helps out the fishery in the long run for both fishermen and the fish itself in the lake. Nobody likes catching little fish. Everybody complains. They call the DWR dirty names when all they do is go and catch little fish. But if they go and catch big fish, they brag about it to everybody, including the out-of-staters. They hear about it, and they bring their dollars in here to catch big fish. Right now, 5 years ago, in this state, I fished over 200 days a year on Utah waters. Last year and this year, I have fished just barely over 100 days in Utah waters. I've just about fished that many days in other states. I have 4 other state fishing licenses that I go to and fish more than Utah because of the size of fish here now. But the one question that I heard somebody ask about spearfishing in Jordanelle, before they got up there and spearfished,
One thing that I have learned about spear fishing from other states and also from a television show, because
Are you representing the group or are you speaking for yourself?
I'm representing the Utah Bass Federation and a lot of bass clubs and even of individual fishermen.
That gives you 2 more minutes. Thank you.
Okay. But anyway, the spear fishermen on a show, Hook and Look, I contacted those guys and asked them because I seen one show where they was actually pushing the bass away from the camera or away from the guy's face when he was diving. And I asked him, why is that normal or whatever? And they basically said that the lakes that have the smallmouth in them, and even largemouth, but mainly smallmouth, they can go and sit on the bottom, and the bass will actually come over to them. And they say that you have to push them out of the way, or they become a nuisance. And the bigger the bass, the more they will come at the divers, basically territorial. And spear fishing, there's no catch and release with a spear. Once you hit it with a spear, it's dead. And big smallmouth are a real valuable item. There's people that travel a lot of miles to go catch smallmouth of a bigger size. I'm one of them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sackett. Well, next. Hear from Paul Drummond.
Well, I'm Paul Drummond. I'm the chairman of the Utah Anglers Coalition. A little bit of background. We're made up of the Rocky Mountain Anglers, Walleye People, Bass Federation, Trout Unlimited, Salt Lake County Fish and Game, Friends of Strawberry, Federation of Fly Fishers, Strawberry Anglers, and multiple commercial organizations. We have been working with the division probably for 4, 5, 6 months going over these regulations, and we've had quite a bit of discussion, particularly in the regard for the two-day possession limit. And when it was all said and done, again, with getting understanding from them, we fully support that two-day possession, excluding strawberry because of the value of that fishery. And we'll see what happens in the study when it goes down the pike on that one. And we also want to compliment the folks. We were a little bit involved in the beginning on the spearfishing. That was a very, very difficult issue and a lot of tense, bad feelings. And my compliments to the division personnel as well as Terry and George Summers. And lastly, there has been some discussion on increasing that to a 3-day possession limit on fish, particularly in light of the drought situation this year, maybe next year, and without any knowing what would happen on the fisheries. The Anglers Coalition is very much opposed to extending beyond 2-day possession until we know a whole lot more about the system. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Drummond. We'll next hear from Ken Strong.
Thank you. Ken Strong, representing Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity I have to stand before you this time and for the effort that you guys put into working with rules and regulations that would help this state in the future. Paul, I was going to, wherever you disappeared to, I was going to tell you that in 2010, according to the DWR, 40% of the fishing licenses, or a little bit better than 40% of the fishing licenses, came from out of state. So we do have a lot of out of state people here. There's several things I'd like to talk about. Of course, our numbers dropped, our license sales dropped in 2002. Reason for that was when the limit of the fish dropped to 4. So obviously, the limit affects people fishing and coming into the state. Now, I would like to talk about possession limits. We just heard about the 3-day being opposed, and that's good. I talked about Idaho. Idaho has a 2-day possession limit in the field, such as Utah is proposing. Once you hit home in Idaho, those fish no longer count on your limit. SFW would like to agree with the 2-day possession limit that the state has in mind with a three-day possession limit once you are home. So that means you still only get two in the field, but you could have a three-day possession limit at home. That's not going to affect the overfishing on a weekend, and it's not going to compare to Idaho, but it is going to help people if they want a few more fish in their freezer. The other thing is SFW's put so much money into, they've put a lot of money into strawberry, mostly in raising the fish to a little bigger size, and we're worried about strawberry as much as the next person. And we would be the first to say, let's pull the chain on it if we thought a two-day possession limit was going to hurt strawberry. And so we would like to put strawberry and have it a statewide, with the exception of Flaming Gorge. We know Flaming Gorge is dealing with Wyoming, and as was mentioned, that's still 2 years down the road before Wyoming does their plan. But as far as statewide, strawberry would work in that plan, and then it would just be statewide. Nobody would have to worry where they were at. The third thing is cooked fish, and we would like to propose that cooked fish no longer count on your limit. And whether that be canning them, bottling them, or even if you cook them and put them in your fridge and you don't eat them, they still count on your limit. And so once the fish has been cooked, it would no longer count on your limit. Paul mentioned in Kirk Creek changes, they changed the limit to four to standardize the limit. And that's why we're saying with strawberry, let's just standardize it and put it statewide. Thank you for your time. Please take time to consider and appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Next, hear from Brad Bradley.
Introduce myself before Brad Bradley from Manti, Utah. I guess I'm just representing the 98% of fishermen that don't belong to a special interest group and never show up at these things. So I've got two recommendations I'd like to bring up. I threw the one out at Richfield last week, the two fish limit, flies and lures only on carp. It didn't go over very well down there, so... Anyway, what I'd really like to propose, the division on page 14 of the fishing proclamation, it talks about how you can take carp. And I don't know that, I guess we're kind of afraid of this one thing that sounds like it's so efficient and so dangerous, the harvesting carp, that we just can't have it out there, and that's the crossbow. Threatening to wipe out all the carp in the state of Utah. Well, maybe not. But anyway, I'd like to see that struck from the proclamation. Make crossbows legal for carp. We can stab them. We can spear them. We can shoot them with a bow. We can net them. You know, we can do about everything to them. Let's include crossbow fishing along with it, too. We've got a lot of... I know Cabela's down there selling crossbows and stuff, and we don't have a lot of use for them other than handicap. Deer hunters in the state of Utah, it'd be nice to be able to go fish with them. Recommendation number one. Recommendation number two, along with everybody else that's here, I'd like to thank the division for looking at increasing the fishing limit on trout. I think that's something that's probably been needed to do for quite a while. If we look at our surrounding states, Utah's at the bottom of the pile on possession. You can go to Colorado, Wyoming, Idaho, Nevada, Arizona, and they hardly have any water down there, and you can keep six fish down there. So Utah is the most restrictive state on the trout limit of all of them in the Intermountain West, and I think we're better than that. I think we have more fish out there, and I think we have the ability to allow people to harvest on those fish. I'm going to be so liberal here, I'll almost sound like a Democrat. I'd like to go back to the 2001 eight fish limit. Right now, when you look at your regulation that you've got, it's several lines long. You can have four fish on one day, four fish on the other day. It can't be processed. Da 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 da. It'd really be nice for that little girl that's on the Take Me Fishing poster that's trying to understand what's going on to just say, eight fish in possession, you're done. It doesn't matter whether you catch two fish on Saturday, six fish on Sunday, four fish on Saturday, four fish on Sunday, whatever, eight fish is it was a suitable limit prior to 2002, and your fishing license sales prior to 2002, they were running there above that 450,000 fishermen mark. Looked pretty good. When you dropped your four fish limit, you had a pretty serious buyer resistance. You lost about 50,000 fishermen, and you've been fighting ever since to try and get them back. The only thing that's got you back close to that 50,000 or 450,000 line the last few years, you'll have to thank the big game guys for that, because they made people buy a hunting license or a combination license in order to apply for their deer elk. And you see that bump come up right there when that was made. Apparently a lot of guys decided, well, if I gotta buy a hunting license to get my big game license, I might as well buy a combination license and go fishing. When I look at the enforcement of it, I appreciate what the enforcement section of the division is saying, that they will deal with it. Yeah, they have to deal with what the biologists throw out. But I think it's a pretty difficult law to enforce. I mentioned it to one friend. He already solved the problem. He said, well, I just have to carry my sleeping bag on my four-wheeler when I go from now on. So whenever I stopped, I've been camping, and I'll have my eight fish. I think it's a tough one to enforce. And really, unless the officer wants to sit right on a trailer and make sure they were there on Friday and not on Saturday and not on Friday night, then as soon as they get them back to the trailer, they're probably King's X as far as their second limit. So I'd like to see that switch to eight. And I see you nodding your head, and you're going like, I think he spent his minutes.
Yeah, yep, you're out of time.
I know John would do that because I want to get him off the podium.
Thank you for your comments.
No. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for your comments. Okay, we'll next hear from Barry.
I'm representing the United Wildlife Cooperative. Don't have a lot to say other than I'd like to compliment the workers that made the spearfishing regulation proposals. I think those are outstanding. As far as what our members are concerned about, a lot of what's been discussed has been covered, but I would encourage the division to continue monitoring the Willard Bay inlet situation closely, both from how the law enforcement is being conducted, if it's too much, if the snagging is out of control, if it's providing the opportunity hoped for. A lot of our members are concerned about that. Otherwise, other concerns, we continue to support the current regulations at Minersville. I know that's not in the central region. And we're conducting our member surveys on some things. We don't have full results back yet. But overall, again, to repeat, great work on the spearfishing regs. We fully support that. And we would encourage continued monitoring of the Willard Bay situation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Barry. We'll next hear from Jerry Reist. Sorry. I don't have a hook on it.
Jerry Reist, Utah Spear Fishing Association. Thanks for your time. I'd just like to thank Paul Dremon, Paul Bergey, and Drew Cushing for all the effort that they've put into accommodating our group and our activity. We, as spear fishermen, we see ourselves no different than any other sportsman sees himself, and someone who's vitally concerned about the health and the health of the fisheries within the state. We see ourselves no less or no more than sportsmen than compared to any other hook and line or any other type of sportsman. We're fishermen, we're hunters, just like anybody else. I would like to, so again, thank you to them for them, all their effort. They did a great job of putting us all together in the same room and helping us work things out. They were instrumental on that. One proposal I'd like to make is for the 2014 survey. That survey be placed on there, or the question proposed, that in any waters where there's a catch and kill on any given species, that spearfishing for those species be allowed. We think it's appropriate, and we'd like to, you know, be willing to wait till 2014 survey to have that placed out to the general public to get their comments and feelings on it. With regard to the other thing that while Paul was accurate, not everything that we came away with, we didn't get everything that we asked for. I would like to make these informational comments only to this council, that currently the proposal puts into place a moratorium on spearfishing for small and largemouth bass during a certain period of time during the spawn, with the effect that it's going to protect those species while they're on their nests spawning. And we, as spearfishermen and as a group in whole, as a whole, we absolutely support that proposal. Would like to point out that during that same period of time, a hook and line fisherman can catch and keep any legal limit of those same small and largemouth basses. And as spear fishermen and as sportsmen, we don't really see a difference between a fish in the cooler, whether it's been shot by a spear gun or whether it's been hook and line caught. Just FYI on that. Also, for and just general comments for people on the council and in the audience. Smallmouth bass are curious, and the gentleman's comments about their activity or their behavior is fairly accurate. So as spear fishermen, it's required of us to use our selectivity prior to pulling the trigger, and that's basically what we have to do. Small and largemouth bass aren't always on the top of our list for fish to fish for. So just because they're there doesn't mean we're shooting them. And I know for me, I haven't, in this state, in a year and a half of fishing, I haven't gone home with a limit of any single species ever. And I'm not saying that every spear fisherman does that, but it's fairly common. And so there's plenty of other fish besides bass out there to spearfish. With regard to the proposals that have been placed by the addition of the waters to make those open to us for spearfishing, we feel as a body that it's also going to reduce the pressure on the waters that are currently available to us. And so we strongly support the proposals that have been made by Paul and Drew. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Terry. We'll next hear from Jesse Kennicott.
Jesse Kennicott, I'm not representing the Utah Spear Fishing Association. I'm sure you can only get one representative for association, but I am a Utah Spear Fisherman. I wanted to give a little background. I've only been doing it for about 3 years. I'm a hunter. I hunt deer and elk, and I've fished with very limited success most of my life, like most fishermen do. Most of the guys in this room probably outfished me like crazy, but I'm just like you guys. My old man, for the first time in his life in 53 years, didn't draw out this year for a deer tag. We've been depressed about that forever. But a friend of mine recommended, go out, rent a wetsuit, and come with me to a spearfishing competition. He borrowed me his gun, and I haven't been able to put it down since. Anybody who has any qualms about spearfishing, I will lend you my gun to try it. Okay? It's not as easy as you think. Out of the 200 roughly spearfishermen in the state, and I doubt that's actually accurate, it's probably less than that, only 10% or so can actually hold their breath long enough to go down and wait for any period of time. I suck. Okay? I can't go down and wait for anything. I see what's on the surface. I hardly see any bass at all. And in the type of waters we fish here, it's extremely dirty. You could about 10, 15 feet of visibility tops. It's not as easy as you think it is. And like I said, anybody who wants to try, I have a go. Feel free to, you know, borrow it from me. I will say that the one thing, one recommendation that I would have that wasn't brought up that I kind of came into late, and I want to also mirror Terry, thanks to Paul and Drew, and all the other guys from the
UAC that got together and helped us with a little bit and come together on a compromise. Night fishing for stripers at Powell, that'd be kind of fun for us. I don't see any problem with it. Allow us to go out there, shoot a species. It's kind of fun for us. We don't get a chance to go out under the lights very often. Burbot and Flaming Gorge, allowed. Why not allow us to do it down at Powell? I agree with everything that we've done as far as increasing the spearfishing here in the state. I would love to be able to do more waters. I mean, why not? My opinion, okay, why not just let us do everything everybody else can? You know? Since I put on a wetsuit and had a spear gun in my hand, first time in my life I've felt like the minority. It's been a little weird. Had rocks thrown at me, cussed at, yelled at. Okay? I've never felt like that in my life. But why can't I be able to do what I love to do, my passion in spearfishing, the same way everybody else can take your hook and line and go out and do it? That's my opinion. So, appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. Our last one is Robert Dibley. Robert here. Hey, Jim, would you like to go?
My name is Jim Carter, and I represent the Strawberry Anglers Association. And I want to tell you that I'm very happy with the group that we have here tonight and everybody that's bringing up their comments. One of the things that I think is important that we should think about is that Strawberry Reservoir is one of the, well, it is the major fishery in the state of Utah, has been forever, and it's been a big family fishery and one that we have been working with for years. Back in the 1990s, the reservoir was poisoned and started again. And 10,000 anglers signed a petition for the wildlife resources to stock the rainbows in Strawberry. And that group of anglers created the Strawberry Anglers Association back 15 years ago. And our goal in the Strawberry Anglers, and I will read you from the document, the first one written. Our goal was to protect the Strawberry Valley fishery from any type of threat, to work hand in hand with the Division of Wildlife Resources to ensure the best methods are used and the best results are gained for the money spent in the Strawberry Valley. There's a whole bunch of others on the list. All of those are directed towards the fishery group working hand in hand with wildlife resources biologists to create the fishery that we have at Strawberry. A few years ago, the American fishery aquatics people got together on a national level and voted Strawberry Reservoir as the best managed fishery in the United States. That was not anglers, that was biologists. I feel like what the division is doing right now with their proposal to protect the Strawberry on this two-day fish limit is in the best interest of the fishery and the people who fish Strawberry. You heard earlier that 1.2 million hours a year is what is generally on Strawberry. It has dropped a few hundred hours in the last few years. But a number of years ago, it was 80,000 when I was a kid. The point that the Strawberry Anglers would like to say, let's take care of the Strawberry Reservoir. Let's not do anything to it that may impact negatively the type of fishing we have right now. That brings people from all over the world. It brings people from all over the state. And everybody that you talk to are not unhappy with strawberry because of the size of fish, because of the quality of fish, and because of the management of the reservoir and the law enforcement of the reservoir. The Strawberry Anglers Association supports totally the proposal that the division has made on this proposed change in the license, not the license, but the regulations. Strawberry anglers totally support that. And I want to thank all of you. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, Robert Dibley.
Hi, I'm Bobby Major Powell. I totally agree with what has been said about the strawberry on the two fish limit. I don't think we should actually, you know, forget about what happened in the past when we had a high rate of fish taken out of the strawberry. And right now, on the latest report that we had, that the chub population has spiked up higher. And so if we start taking more of these fish out of strawberry, it could be a reoccurrence of what happened back when we had to kill off the whole reservoir to kill the chubs. And as for the eight fish a day count, a survey was done by the DWR a while back, and the overwhelming majority of people were happy with the four fish a day take. There are very few people that take eight fish, and thinking that this is going to draw people in from the other states, it's just not a true factor. And a lot of people that come in from the other states come here for trophy fish. And if you start taking eight fish a day out of the water, trout out of the water, you are not going to have trophy fish. And also, with a survey that the DWR did, that 74% to 75% of the people do not even keep their fish. And so therefore, I would hate to see us go to an eight fish limit and also not keeping the two fish limit at strawberry.
Thank you, Mr. Dibley. Quinn Woodsmany.
Yeah, I'm Quinn Woodmansey. I'm with Salt City Bass. I'm currently the president of the club. In comment earlier about the bass, we're out fishing for bass around the bedtimes and everything else. We're not putting them in the coolers. Currently, our club, during those times of the year, we do a paper tournament where as soon as they are caught, they are immediately released. So our mortality rates are up there. We're not keeping them that way. Also, what I'd like to see as a group, or a group would like to see, is possibly a specialized license for spear fishermen. So that you guys can probably get control or get an idea really how many are out there. You know, for other species, we have to apply for licenses. I have certain sports, you have to apply for a different license. I don't know why spearfishing would be any different. Also, my comment, I'm one of the ones that really pushed the issue for banning spearfishing during the spawn. It's not just for bass. I'd like to see it across the board for other species also. Those fish are all subject to, I mean, they're subject. They're doing one thing and one thing only, so they're subject to taking it a little bit easier sometimes. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you. Ronald Levine.
Ronald Levine, Sandy, Utah, speaking for myself. There's safe or supposedly safe limits on mercury consumption, but I don't believe in that. I personally choose to minimize my mercury consumption much less. Last year was an exception. I disregarded that because I had an exceptionally good year catching big fish, which was my goal. Now that I've succeeded in doing that, I've accomplished that. I want to move on to my next goal. I want to catch and eat small fish. Small fish are younger. They haven't been around as much. They haven't consumed a lot of fish to get to any to get to that size, a big fish consumes a whole lot of small fish. I'd be putting much lower demand on the ecosystem consuming small fish. But the thing about consuming small fish is I eat a lot. I want a bigger meal than two small fish or four very small fish. And I think, well, for example, on the walleye, where it was catch and kill, but you didn't want to insist that people consume the walleye where they contained mercury because it was an advisory against consuming them. I would like to say the same thing. Having the limits the way they are, where if I could catch two fish or four fish, I'm going to catch big fish. It's encouraging me to eat the older fish that have on the top of the food chain that's consumed a lot of small fish, and then I'd be getting more mercury in my diet, whereas my preference would be to consume more of smaller fish. And the way to do that, I think, below a certain size, you might not say the limit is so many fish. You might set the limit as so many pounds as an alternative. That's all.
Okay, thank you very much. Lee Rasmussen.
I'm Lee Rasmussen. I'm the chairman of the Blue Ribbon Fisheries Advisory Council. I've hesitated to say anything, but feel that I really must say it at this point. One of the crown jewels of our Blue Ribbon waters in this state is strawberry. We put a lot of money into it. We have a rare situation in there that we have two very well-trained biologists and experienced biologists that manage that. I think what we're doing by granting a two-day limit up there without a real effective way of enforcing it is really saying nothing more and honestly being, and I think we need to be honest with ourselves, we've just changed the limit to 8 fish. Now, if people want to keep 8 fish, we have another jewel in the Blue Ribbon fisheries. That's the Middle Provo. We have an overabundance of fish there because fishermen will pack them out. They're too damn lazy to do it. You know, if they want to catch all those fish and have that, let them do it there. But strawberry is such an important factor to us in our Blue Ribbon program that it needs to be protected. We've already said that it needs to be protected with our cutthroats so that we keep our chub problem, and with our rainbows so that we can keep enticing people to come there. 4 is a great catch in a day. And there are, and you can do that up there now. It hasn't always been that way. We now have it up to where it's functioning. Don't mess around with it. Keep it like it is. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other comments from the audience? Okay, seeing none, I'll kind of bring it back to the rack. I'd just like to quickly review some of the points of interest made by the audience members. We had Paul Kelly that is concerned about burying fish. as much as lake and river and levels fluctuate, that one could get nasty real easy. So anyway, I understand that concern. We also had Clifford, who was concerned about the limit, and it's the slot limit was his primary impetus he wanted to see. I'm thinking that was a great idea. Paul was opposed to the three-day limit. Ken Strong, wanted to change that to the three-day limit at home. I don't know how many of you have fish in your freezer or bottled fish on your shelves at home. You know, I don't. I do. So I also understand those concerns. Brad Bradley would like to slam carp with crossbows. Okay. Barry, for the United Wildlife Cooperative, supported the spearfishing proposal, but he's still quite concerned about Willard Bay and the tributaries coming in. Terry Rice, spear fisherman, would like to address the catch and kill areas, why, you know, logically there's, he sees no reason there shouldn't be spearfishing with the catch and kill fisheries for those species of fish. Jesse Cancott supported the spearfishing, more like hunting than fishing. Jim Carter, stripers under the lights, he'd like to see that happen. Well, that was Jesse, okay. Jim Carter was a strawberry. He supports the division's proposal, concerned about any possible threat. I know I heard him as they were talking about it. Paul mentioned that if they could at any point see something going haywire with this plan, that they would introduce changes at that point. Robert Dibley, supported the division. Quinn Woods Manny, the bass guy, he was concerned about spearfishing during the spawn, also about, you know, possible a special tag for spear fishermen or hunters of fish. Like to see no spearfishing during any spawning for any game fish. Ronald Levine is concerned about biological magnification and mercury consumption. I'm not sure. I'll just support him in his idea to eat more smaller fish. Lee Rasmussen, concerned about the two-day limit at Strawberry and how that's going to actually impact it. That's kind of a general rundown of the questions or the comments and concerns from the audience. I'll turn it over to the RAC for their comments and disposition, and just let you talk about it for a minute. Richard.
This would be for Paul. I just want to know, they brought up about a slot limit for bass. What do you think about that idea? Is there a value to it? Is it unnecessary? What do you think?
There are a lot of things that impact the number of large fish and small fish in any particular species. It is unfair to try and put Strawberry, the slot limit Strawberry Reservoir, against a slot limit for bass. For one thing, in general, two things. One is that we have tremendous pressure at Strawberry. We mentioned 30% exploitation rate on the rainbows at Strawberry, and we do not see that same kind of exploitation rate on the bass. And we need to have, one of the tenets of an effective slot limit is that you have to have harvest. Otherwise, the slot limit does not make any difference. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is that we control the number of fish that go into Strawberry Reservoir through our stocking program. Bass naturally recruit. So in good water years, they pull off a good spawn. In bad water years, they don't have it as a good a spawn. So their numbers are more self-regulating from that standpoint. Now, having said all that, we're working with our regional biologists right now to collect samples to do age and growth work on our bass populations on a number of waters around the state. We have not had the ability to do that before because of manpower restrictions, et cetera, but we are moving in that direction. There may be some waters in the state that require a different bass limit than we have right now. But we don't know that per se on any water in the state. What we do know is, based on some preliminary information that we have received from the age and growth work, for example, at Pelican, a 9-year-old bass in Pelican right now is about 10 inches long. Now, that means that there are probably too many bass in there for the available habitat and food, and they're doing what we call stunting. The only way to overcome that is to remove bass. So I suspect that we're going to see that same kind of result from a number of our waters. Over 90% of our bass right now are released based on our creel survey. So it becomes difficult to manage it when you don't have any harvest, any way of effectively controlling the population.
any reason why we can't use crossbows for carp and non-game species? What's the reason behind that?
Right now, crossbows can be used by disabled anglers. They go through the same COR process as disabled hunters. That was a request from that we trim that to that particular restriction based on a request from a wildlife board member a year ago when we went through that rule process. It's my understanding right now from a discussion at an earlier RAC meeting that the division is meeting with the wildlife board and others to look at the crossbow rule. I am not in a position to comment on that other than I've heard that it's being discussed right now and it probably be brought to the RAC in a future time.
We were not part of the negotiation or the compromise between the sport fishermen and the spear fishermen. The spear fishermen have indicated they'll wait till 2014 to get into those catch and kill areas.
Right.
Does that tip that compromise to do that now?
I don't know. I can tell you that over 90% of the waters that have catch and kill regulations on them at the moment are in the proposed list of spearfishing waters. The ones that we went through the rule the other day after we talked with Terry and tried to identify which ones were not in that current proposal. The ones that are not in the current proposal right now are the Green, San Juan, Colorado Rivers, and Utah Lake. With the exception of the A section of the Green River, that is that section between Tail Race and Little Hole, visibility in those other waters is probably so poor that the spear fishermen would not want to be in there, but that's something we need to talk to them about. There are several other waters that have no limits on certain species, such as smallmouth bass at Sand Hollow and Quail Creek. I'm not sure whether Terry intended to bring those forward. I can tell you that based on our discussion with the bass anglers, there probably would be a lot of pushback in for those waters. So we need to do more work here, but I applaud Terry in saying that we'll take this one step at a time and let's bring the whole public into this discussion.
I was a little confused with, I think it's Mr. Rasmussen from the Blue Ribbon Fishery. He was talking about the two-day limit for strawberry, and I read that the current proposal from the DWR only strawberries restricted from that. So that's
correct, right?
Yes, that is correct, and I believe Lee was supporting that position.
Correct. Any other questions or comments from the RAC? Okay, seeing none, I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make that motion that we support the Division of Wildlife Resources recommendations as presented.
Is made by Danny, seconded by Jay. He'll bring it to a vote. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Paul, for your time and efforts. Our next item is an action item. It's establishment about the least chub refuge population, and we'll have Paul. Who's going to talk to us about this?
Chris Crawford.
Okay, thank you.
Unless Paul wants to.
I wouldn't recognize one if I had.
We're going to have to work on that, Paul. You guys bear with me. I may have to find it. Scott? My name is Chris Crockett. When I'm not moonlighting as your doorman, I'm an aquatic biologist. I should get hazard pay for that one. I'm an aquatic biologist with the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. And I'm going to talk very briefly tonight about a project that we're proposing to help benefit least chub, which is a sensitive fish species here in the state of Utah. I just want to start out with a little bit of background because, as Paul alluded to, not everyone knows what a lease chub is. So while I've got a captive audience, I only have about 42 slides detailing a life history that we can go through. So, no, it's as its name implies, it's a pretty small chub. They max out at about 2 inches. So when you say lease chub, a lot of people think Utah chub and think about some of the issues that are associated with Utah chub, but these guys are always small and so therefore always readily available as a prey species for a lot of our other sport fish. There's only six natural populations, I should say, and they're all endemic to Utah, so they're found nowhere else in the world. Historically, they occupied a lot of springs and wetlands throughout the state. They are currently a state-sensitive species and a federal candidate species. Candidate meaning that they were proposed to list under the Endangered Species Act in 2010. The Fish and Wildlife Service came back with a ruling that said that the listing was warranted but precluded due to higher priorities. That's not uncommon for a lot of species. Basically, Fish and Wildlife Service comes back and says, yeah, they may have some issues, but there's a lot of other higher priority, higher profile species that we need to work on. We've been working on conservation of this species for many years. There was a group put together in 2006 to help put together essentially a management strategy for this. It's called the Lease Chub Conservation Agreement and Strategy. It outlines a whole lot of management activities to help with the conservation of this species, one of which is the establishment of permanent, what we call refuge populations. And so a refuge population is essentially just a backup population. You can imagine you don't want to have all your eggs in one basket. If you only have six populations throughout the world, you'd like to set up a few extras so if there's a stochastic event, something happens to one of those populations, that you can come over to this refuge population, you have the genetics represented, you can grab fish from that and restock the wild population or start another population elsewhere. Just a quick overview of the populations that we do have in the state. The yellow dots indicate our current natural populations. You can see the majority of them are in the West Desert associated with some of the springs in the Snake Valley. We also have a population on our Clear Lake WMA, our Mills Valley WMA, and Mona Springs WMA. We are proposing to establish a refuge population for the Mona Springs population. And you can see from the red triangles that we have refuge populations established for many of the other natural populations throughout the state. So this is definitely not the first time it's been done. We have a couple within the central region. A vast majority of those refuge populations, though, are in the northern region. So that kind of leads us into a little bit more detail on our project description. We're proposing to stock approximately 10,000 lease chub from our Wawi hatchery, into a spring complex commonly known as Big Springs. And you can see from the map there, Big Springs complex is just straight west of Fairfield. It's actually pretty much just across the street from the Stagecoach Inn, one of our state parks there. The goal of the project is twofold. First of all, I've already alluded to the fact that we're trying to make a backup population, so we don't have all our eggs in one basket for the Mona Springs wild population. We're also looking to, as a benefit, also reduce mosquito larvae within this complex. We've worked with Salt Lake County on using lease chub throughout some of the ponds in Salt Lake County, the ornamental ponds, introducing lease chub to essentially help control mosquito. And this is an alternative to using mosquito fish or gambusia, which is not native to the state and has impacted negatively a lot of our native fish populations. So it's a twofold. We get a little bang for our buck in a refuge population. The private landowner is interested in the preservation of the species, but he also likes the idea of helping to reduce the mosquito population. It is on private ground. We do have the full support of the landowner. He actually came to us interested in this project. He'd heard about some of our work with other individuals and was excited about the potential. Part of the efforts include the establishment of a memorandum of understanding, an MOU here, essentially just an agreement that we have with a private landowner outlining what we're doing, what his responsibilities are, what our responsibilities are. And one of those options would be that if the species is proposed to be listed, the Fish and Wildlife Service will put out its listing finding. And from 12 months after they put that out, there's public comment period, a little bit of reevaluation. So essentially, if Fish and Wildlife Service does propose to list it, the landowner would have 12 months to decide, does he still want those fish there? By all indications right now, he's saying yes, he does. Of course, he would have the option to change his mind. If he does want to continue to have those there, we would enter into what's called a candidate conservation with assurances agreement, basically just outlining about the same things I've already referred to, except the Fish and Wildlife Service would be a signatory on that document as well. We have contacted the Utah County Commission. We met with them August 20th. The commission was very supportive of our efforts. Fortunately, we have a good relationship with them. They realize that we're trying to do everything we can to keep this species off the endangered species list, keep it within state control. There was actually a Daily Herald article documenting some of that conversation and their support for the project. I've already mentioned our private landowner is definitely on board with this, and we do have a draft MOU, and we would be obtaining final signatures if all goes well. We have submitted it through the RDCC process and received no negative comments. Our next step is we are hoping to get approval and support from the Regional Advisory Council tonight. If we do get that support, we'll finalize our agreement with the landowner. Then we'd propose to stock lease chub as early as November 2013, after which we would annually monitor the population, basically make sure it's doing all right, decide if we want to put more fish in or if there's some mutually beneficial management action that we could take to benefit that species on that private ground. That's all I have. I do want to thank our interested landowners and Mark Grover, who actually did a lot of the legwork for this project. I'd be happy to answer any questions or if you have any comments or suggestions regarding the project.
Thank you very much. Any questions or points of clarification from the RAC? I see none. Are there any questions or points of clarification desired from the audience?
One quick question. Are you only going to put them in the smaller spots that they showed on your map, or are you going to put them in any of the other bigger lakes to see if they can establish a population back in some of the bigger reservoirs around the state?
For this project, we're just specifically talking the Big Springs wetland complex. We do have some other areas throughout the state, for instance, Atherley Reservoir near the town of Faust, where we have put them and they've taken off like gangbusters. At this point in time, we don't have plans to put them in any of the other larger reservoirs. That has been discussed, but right now we don't have any plans to put them in any of the other larger, more traditional reservoirs.
Personally, I see no reason why you couldn't put them in any of the other reservoirs just to see if they won't get established.
Yeah. I think that's...
It would be a welcome, an added fish for the other reservoirs.
I think that's a good idea. We've kind of had that discussion in regards to Yuba and some other areas, and I think that's something that we'll take under consideration in the future. Thanks.
Yeah. Was the range of the least chub bigger at one time, and it's been dwindled to six populations now?
It was historically we know of about 10 other sites throughout the state where we had them. We actually surmise that historically it was the entire Bonneville Basin. So you know you can imagine a great portion of Utah was covered by Lake Bonneville at one time. So we have no reason to believe that there weren't least chub throughout the entire Bonneville Basin. But we do in our records know of about 10 other sites documented, I should say, where we had them previously.
Least chub be an alternative to Gamboge as far as mosquito control?
Definitely. We've done some work with Salt Lake County to that regards and to use them especially in some of these sensitive areas where we don't want to introduce another non-native fish. Just a quick info, Gamboge, they're live bearers, so you can go from having 10 to 10,000 literally in a few months, which is great for controlling the mosquito population, but you can imagine a fish with that sort of reproductive potential can very quickly get away from you. So yes, definitely we've looked at using them in some other areas. I have to say the only thing leash chub have against them are the fact that they don't reproduce quite as quickly. But again, that in our realm helps us be able to control those populations a little better.
As far as where the leash chub is concerned, what vital niche within the environment do they fill that other species don't?
That's a good question. Well, in terms of their benefit to us, as I've already alluded to, they eat a whole lot of mosquito larvae, a lot of midge larvae. Historically, in the areas where they would have been coexisting with our native Bonneville cutthroat trout, obviously they were, you know, providing food for that individual as well. Some of our ponds, they actually will consume a large part of their diet is algae, which can help under eutrophic conditions where we've got issues with algae blooms. They'll actually help whittle that down. So they're definitely kind of low man on the totem pole and the food chain, but of course these are all links in the chain, if you will, of life. So,
and are they mostly restricted to lower elevations then?
Yes. Predominantly any of the areas, say under, you know, historically any of the areas that would have been Lake Bonneville. So the majority are some of these spring complex of fairly low elevation.
Any real negatives?
You know, that's a loaded question right there. I'm up here to talk about the positives.
Are they?
I don't see negatives in terms of any sort of ecosystem interactions where they would all of a sudden turn into a problem like Utah chub at Strawberry Reservoir.
Sorry, one more question. So we're talking about spending resources and money and other things to supporting the population. What if we don't have the leash chub? What is the other side? What will occur if we don't have this?
Well, from our standpoint, of course, we're trying to do everything we can for the benefit of the species, but also to keep the species off the endangered species list. As I mentioned, we have a conservation agreement strategy that guides us, you know, what we're supposed to be doing, just like there's strawberry management plans. There's management plans for Bonneville cutthroat trout. The Fish and Wildlife Service places a lot of emphasis on us having these backup populations. In a way, it kind of buys us time, because you can imagine if you don't have all your eggs in one basket, you know, you're not going to have an emergency listing if all of a sudden a population gets wiped out. You're going to have this backup ready to go where you still have the genetic integrity of that species. The negatives of no action would, in worst case scenario, be a listing by Fish and Wildlife Service, so, and the loss of that species. So,
are they as efficient at reducing mosquito larvae as the Gambeses are?
In the same densities, they're pretty close. Yes, sir. And there's a couple of research papers if you're interested in the specifics of that. I'd be happy to provide the details.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? I need you to state your name if you do ask a question, please.
At least Paul now knows what a leash chub looks like. So.
Okay. All right. If they see no further questions, we'll bring it back to the RAC for their disposition, comments, or a possible motion.
I'd like to make a motion that we accept the leash chub management plan as presented tonight.
Okay, a motion is made by Matt. Seconded by Christine. Any discussion on the motion? You call for a vote. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, we're now down to the Mill Creek Cutthroat Restoration Project, an informational item. I do have one comment card about this. Once your presentation is finished, we'll bring that in. But thank you. Mike Slater will be introducing this information. Thank you.
Thank you.
really appreciate the opportunity to be able to just kind of, again, share some information with the RAC as well as the audience on a particular project that we're working on. I feel it's a project that you may be receiving questions about. If you haven't, you may do so in the future. So hopefully this will provide enough information that you'll be able to answer questions or at least have a feel for what's going on with the Bonneville Cutthroat Trout restoration there in Mill Creek. Some of the objectives behind this, these are similar to what Chris was talking about with the least chub. We're trying to prevent or conserve the Bonneville Cutthroat Trout. This is a similar project to many others that we've done throughout the state to try and increase or expand the range of the Bonneville Cutthroat Trout throughout the state. And this meets a lot of the goals that are established in what we call a conservation and agreement strategy for this species in particular. The Bonneville Cutthroat Trout is the state fish for us, and so it's also a fish that we can go angle for. It's a popular sport fish, so it kind of serves a lot of different purposes in that respect. We feel that this project in particular is going to provide a lot of educational opportunities. Mill Creek is located right here in the Salt Lake Valley on the east side of the valley, so it's right next to a million people. In particular, we have the Boy Scout camp there in the canyon. There's thousands and thousands of boys that go through this camp on an annual basis. They are involved, the Boy Scouts of America are involved. They have a pond there. It will be a part of the project down the road where we're able to instruct the boys to explain to them the life history of the cutthroat trout. They'll be able to see it. They'll be able to experience it. They'll be able to angle for these fish in particular. So, and not just that. Again, just the where we're at. We've got a lot of people that are going to be exposed to this project and are being exposed to this project. It's a part of a larger project. There's a lot of things going to be taking place in Mill Creek Canyon. We've collaborated with lots and lots of different partners, including the Forest Service, who will be very involved in improving habitats and recreational opportunities up Mill Creek Canyon. It will provide, in my opinion, a very unique opportunity for the public to be able to come and, again, fish for the native Bonneville cutthroat trout. Most of the other streams along the Wasatch Front here have brown trout, rainbows, cutbows, a lot of different species. This canyon in particular will have what was here thousands of years ago. It will be made up of a native species complex that people can see, fish for, etc. I alluded to the fact that there's lots of partners. It's not just the Forest Service, but there's a multitude of groups that are involved with this. Anglers, Trout Unlimited, Pacific Corps, local landowners in the canyon, the Boy Scouts, the Division of Wildlife, and others. So it's kind of a neat and unique project. The timeline, John alluded to this earlier, that it's about a 3 to 4 year project that we're working on. And I've got this here for you just so you'll understand. We've split the canyon up into three different sections. And these are associated with different barriers that are within the canyon itself. This is for a couple of reasons. One, we want to be able to provide the fishing opportunities throughout the duration of the project. So this year, for example, we began at the upper reaches of the canyon. We've removed the fish already from that portion. We'll come back in again next year and make sure that we've removed all of the fish in that upper reach, and then we'll add the middle section of the canyon. We'll remove the fish from there. At that point, we'll be able to put Bonneville Cutthroat back into the upper reach, and we'll just follow that step down through the middle section and through the lower section of the canyon. Thus allowing people, for example, this year, they can still go down to the lower or the middle sections of that river, and there's cutthroat, there's rainbows, there's browns, there's all kinds of fish for them to catch. And so by the time we work our way through the whole system, the fish in the top that we put back in there should be large enough for anglers to catch. So it might displace anglers a little bit in some way. You might not be able to fish your favorite hole. You might have to bounce around a little bit, but there will be fishing opportunities available. Where it's located, we've had a lot of questions thinking that this was going to go right down through town. This is just in the canyon, about 9 miles of stream. And again, as you can see on the map here, it's separated into three different sections, maybe four if you want to count the top portion, which is actually fishless. We have not had to go up in there with rope known to remove fish or anything because there's no fish there. That will serve a purpose for us in providing food, bugs, things like that for the fish when we put the fish back in. It's kind of just drift down into the system for us. So, I mentioned this that this last week. We, the Division of Wildlife, Forest Service, a lot of Trout Unlimited volunteers, private individuals, participated in the removal of the fish in that upper 3 miles of stream. The way that was done was with rope known. That's a question that we get a lot. You know, what is it? How does it work? It's basically, it's a root from South America that's ground up and it's put into the system or dripped into the river at very, very low concentrations, but it inhibits the fish's or gill organism's ability to utilize the oxygen. So it's not going to hurt the deer, the elk, the dog, you or I. It's just the fish that it's affecting primarily. And so it's a very effective fisheries management tool to go in and remove all of the fish. We could go in mechanically and try and move them all, but we're never going to get them all. And in a project like this, it wouldn't do us a whole lot of good if we didn't remove every rainbow, because we could put our cutthroat back in the next year. Then you're going to receive that hybridization. You'll lose that genetic integrity or purity that we're after to be able to call this a pure cutthroat trout population. We got more comments or questions on the pink water in the bottom right there. What that is that's potassium permanganate that we put into the stream. That neutralizes the effects of the rope known that's in the stream. Again, we're separating this canyon into three different sections. We only wanted to remove fish to a certain point. From that point down, we neutralize the effects of that rope known, but it does make a display of a different colored river down through there. I dare say we had 400 or 500 people stopping and asking what's going on, what's the deal. In addition to all the signs, the public meetings, the things that we've done to try and explain what was going on, but it was very positive, the comments and the concerns, questions, or whatever that we received. So that was a good sign with what we're doing, and we'll be able to continue on with this over the next few years. So that being said, if you have any questions, or if I didn't cover that enough, I'd be happy to answer that for you.
Thank you. I have a comment card from Paul Calley. You'd like to speak to this?
Again, Paul Calley. I'm the Natural Resources and Plant Staff Officer. We really appreciate the time and effort that Mike and the rest of the division staff have put into this project, as far as especially in the public outreach portion. Having two open houses, we've also met up there with the state legislative folks. We've met up there with federal congressional staffers, the newspaper. Really commend the division for the extra effort put in outreaching to the public and trying to explain what's occurring and their participation as we look at the overall habitat restoration there in Mill Creek. We really think that this will be a real opportunity. We get about 13,000 visitors or vehicles, not visitors, vehicles up there during the summer every week. So it's a really high-use canyon, pretty visible. Like Mike said, we have been working closely with the Scout Council, other private landowners, trying to be sure that they understood why we were doing it, the value that we felt like this project provides for the general public of Utah. So thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Any other comments, questions? All right, thank you. Are you going to talk to us about the Yuba?
I am, yeah. All right. One other thing I would mention is I think in that packet that the RAC that you members received, there's actually a plan that kind of explains a lot more details exactly what this is, why it is, when, where, et cetera. And I'd ask you to kind of refer to that if you've got any more questions on that. So
thank you. Okay, we're now another informational item. It'll be the Yuba Reservoir Management Plan. It'll be presented by Mike Slater.
Okay. Yuba Reservoir Management Plan, this is kind of a trend that we're following with a lot of our waters throughout the state. each specific water. We want to know and understand what we're doing, what we're working on. And in order to do that, it's not made up of a bunch of biologists that sit down together and decide this is what we need to do with this reservoir. Times have changed. Years ago, that really was the way it worked. Biology was king, and that told us what we were going to do with a particular body of water. But as I said, things have changed, and it's been a good change. We've been able to incorporate a lot of the public and involve anglers, different groups to participate in this and to see where we want to go and where they want to go with it. So Yuba Reservoir, just a little bit of background. Traditionally, it's been a walleye perch fishery for years and years. Some years it's good, and many years it's bad. And we've tried many different ways to try and dampen those peaks and valleys out through various different means. We've looked at extensive studies through the university, habitat projects, stocking and transplanting, and regulation changes, different ways of monitoring the fishery. We've done a lot, so it's not something that we've just decided maybe we need to try and do something with. We've been working on this for several years. And it's involved the public for quite some time on what we can do and how we can work with it and make changes. In 2003, to make some dam repairs, the reservoir was drained, and there was a lot of hope that that was going to be the answer, that things were going to come back and everything was going to be fixed and we were going to have the walleye perch fishery that the anglers, the division, others wanted to have. We were patient, maybe a little too patient in some people's minds in trying to make that happen or let that happen. And we were also surprised with some of the results and some of the things that took place, namely the advancement of the northern pike. That was not something that anybody expected, and they are now the dominant predator species or game species that's in that reservoir. They have overruled the walleye, if you will. And so in that respect, we've decided, okay, we need to take a harder look at this. What can we do? Are there some things that we can do? And that's where we established an official working group, again, comprising of anglers, different agencies, water users, vendors, a large conglomerate of different interests, and to try and see what we could do. And that was officially established last year in about June. And we met on a monthly or every other month basis since that time and feel that we have a great plan that we all agree with, that we feel we can work with, that was completed in July of this year, and that's kind of what I'm trying to present here. I would like to mention that the common goal or criteria that was come up, what we're really trying to do there is create a more consistent fishery that would attract anglers and within the complex of the aquatic species, both the predator and the prey, and they must be able to thrive within that system. There's a lot of constraints at Yuba, well, at any reservoir, the water use, whether it goes up or down, and when that takes place, and what kind of species you have. So there's a lot of things that we don't get to change, and we had to work within that realm in order to come up with creating a better fishery. So the major goals that were finalized was we want to manage Yuba for a consistent, stable walleye fishery, but we also wanted to have a northern pike or a trophy northern pike aspect to the fishery as well, thus the regulation changes that you heard about a little bit earlier tonight. We want to establish Yuba as a destination fishery. In the past, when the walleye fishing was really good, that's really what it was. We had people coming from several states coming to Yuba specifically to catch those walleye. And we want to try and reestablish that. There's a few gaps that we fill in our data, some of the things that we're collecting or maybe not collecting or the way that we're collecting. And so we're putting a lot of emphasis on how we do that, how the Division of Wildlife goes and monitors that reservoir to see if we can tease some things out there. And then ultimately we're trying to increase the catch rates, again, of the walleye, the perch, and to some respects the northern pike. I've listed this here. This is in the plan that you have. Just wanted to throw a couple of things out just so you see how this plan is developed. We've tried to put a timeline to some of the things that we actually want to work on. One of them, obviously, is coming here and presenting it to you, allowing you to give us some input or some thoughts on what this plan might mean for Yuba and for maybe, again, constituents here in the central region. One of the primary goals of the group was to transplant or increase the numbers of yellow perch, the forage fish, for the walleye as well as the pike, to try and make that happen, and we're in the process of doing that. Again, I mentioned that we might change our monitoring a little bit. We'll be down there this fall doing some netting that we typically haven't done, so we'll change things in that way. And then we'll continue to work towards transplanting or purchasing more yellow perch, more of that forage base. We really feel that that's probably the missing link, or the big elephant in the room, if you will, is there's just not enough food to feed all the predators that are in that reservoir. So we'll continue to try and find more funds, additional funds, to put more perch in there and potentially stock walleye in the reservoir as well. That's something that we typically haven't done as an agency. We stock lots and lots of trout. We're going to try and look at that same method with some of these warm water fish as well. Can we make a difference by putting both walleye and perch into a reservoir like we would trout? And then we're going to monitor this. How is it working? There's some things that may completely fail, and that's okay. We just want to find out and try and narrow some things down as to see what we can do to make the improvements and create the kind of fishery that anglers and others are wanting there. So in a nutshell, that's kind of what's involved or what's within that plan that we've developed. And I do need to say thanks to, again, many anglers, groups, others that have devoted an awful lot of time towards putting their input into this and making this happen and coming up with what I feel is a good product, something that we can kind of follow.
So. Mike, I have a question. Would it ever make sense to take perch out of Fish Lake and put them in Yuba? Or is that just not even conceivable?
That is in the plan. That's something that we will be doing next spring. We actually have an overabundance of perch in Fish Lake. It's a fish that's not really desirable there for various different reasons. And so that's in the plan itself. We will go down next spring right as they are trying to spawn, when we have an effective or the ability to catch those fish, and we'll transplant those from Fish Lake and put them into Yuba. Again, that'll be right after the ice is coming off at Fish Lake. Don't know if it will be quite as effective as going out and buying thousands and thousands of perch and bringing them into the state, but it's another option, again, to put more perch, more forage fish in there. So that's part of the plan. Another thing that the anglers have actually presented is they would like to go down and angle for or hook and line perch and bring some of those in. That, again, you're going down in levels of efficiency on things, but that's something that they can participate in, they can help, and so that's something else that we're looking at.
Are they going to put any trout back in there?
We don't have any plans to initially or right now. We did in the interim when that reservoir was drained in 2003. We knew that we weren't going to have any fish in there for a while. So in order to, again, provide a fishing opportunity, we didn't have perch, walleye, things like that to stock, so we put some rainbows in there. And it created quite the stir, quite a bit of interest.
Well.
There was a lot of 3 to 5 pound rainbows in there. Without the presence of the walleye, the pike, and other things, yeah, they can survive. But when they're in the presence of all these other fish, it makes it pretty difficult and very, very expensive to feed all those fish and get a few to your hooks. So, yeah.
And Danny?
Yeah, so Mike, have we established, is it a reproductive or is it just a recruitment issue with the yellow perch? I mean, it's kind of like stocking the atmosphere with bacteria, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Once they're there, what's the problem?
We're working within some constraints that we have at that reservoir. The reservoir is declining in elevation right when we need kind of a stable water level. And so that's something that's really hard to work with. Yes, we're bringing in fish, hoping that they can pull off a spawn. Earlier comments tonight were made about bass. Some years you get a good spawn and some years you don't. A lot of that depends on water elevations and the presence of water at a certain elevations. So yeah, we're going to try and overload the reservoir with perch and hope for some spawn years, some good spawn years, but we can't count on that. But
wouldn't those introduced fish just be, you know, the length was what? It was
3 to 8 inches is
what
we're trying to.
Yeah, 3 to 8 inches. Gape size-wise, wouldn't they just be gobbled right up?
Yeah. With the northern pike in there, I could stock 14-inch yellow perch, and they're still going to be within the gape limits.
It kind of seems like a feel-good thing, but...
It's a feel-good thing, but this is the best option that we've been able to come up with. And we feel that if we can saturate it enough, that, yeah, some of those are going to survive. And that's been proven in the past, that there's some years when we've got all the perch in the world down there, and some years we don't.
So why don't we take more northern pike out of there then?
That's what we're trying to do with the regulations, where we've increased the regulations on the northern pike to 20 instead of the statewide regulation. Which
but
is
only
six.
one over 36, right? So,
right. So we want to take all those hammerheads out. We want all those 20 to 24-inch fish to be removed, if at all possible. And that's the overwhelming majority of what you see in the reservoir. The reason for the one over 36 is it's drawn an awful lot of attention to that reservoir. We've had multiple state record northern pike caught out of there this year, you know, over 26 pounds, 45 inches. I mean, these are big fish. And so we're trying to do a little bit of both. We want to remove those pike, but yet there's a lot of people saying, you better leave some of those big ones so I can go down and catch them. We can't make everybody happy all the time. So it's a compromise, if you will.
One other, you know, we've got a new mercury advisory on the lake. Have we checked the perch?
What timing on that, huh? When we're trying to encourage the harvest of the northern pike, we now have a mercury advisory.
Right.
On the pike.
Have we checked the yellow perch?
We have given them yellow perch, but I don't know that they've either not sampled them yet or got the results back yet or what the deal is there. But whenever we go sampling, they will take pretty much all the species that we're collecting in our nets.
They have not found it in the perch, best of my knowledge.
I just don't know if we have results or if they actually found it being negative.
They have not found it.
Good.
That's one more comment on the plan. The plan looks great, but I think the advisory came out too late to include mercury as an issue in the list of, what was it, 11 constraints. Well, obviously mercury is a pretty significant constraint, so...
Yeah.
So anyway, just mentioning it in the plan would probably be a good idea.
That might be a good thing. One thing in the plan is we will be meeting probably on a biannual basis with this working group, and that's going to allow us to make modifications, change things, see where we can improve or do something different.
So is this a draft?
This is considered final, but again, as part of this plan, we will be meeting on a biannual basis to see where are we at. Do we need to make modifications? If something's not working, we have the ability to modify this plan.
But you understand our concern. I mean, if we have high levels of mercury in the perch, and perch are considered a primary freshwater food fish, then we have a problem.
Right.
So we may have to move ahead and not include it in the plan, but just move ahead with an advisory later on if that's true.
Right, if it comes back as, according, it sounds like we have, it's negative on the perch, and I'm not aware of that, but I'll look into that a little bit further.
Isn't there a wide discrepancy in between the federal and the state levels of mercury tolerance?
There is, yeah. But we've worked through that with the Division of Wildlife and the Department of Health, and we are working under the Department of Health's recommendations. People that eat food, there's two different levels, as you say. EPA is for the environmental impacts of that mercury, whereas the health department is more of what are the impacts to you and I eating that fish, and that is more stringent, and that is the one that we will be going by and will continue to go by. So it makes it a little more difficult.
Isn't the federal one an impact on eating as well? Isn't it, so
there's two different standards between the two. Absolutely. Yeah.
But there's an FDA limit, an EPA limit.
The EPA limit
is much more stringent than the FDA, but the mercury working group's based on the EPA
guideline. So I was explaining that just the opposite. Andy?
A list of the worst offenders of bodies of water
for mercury.
Because that makes news. But I'd like to see the least list of the best places that have the least. Where could I find that?
I would consider any list, any water that's not on that list, because that's a good water. I don't know that we could go and test every single water. Well, they aren't going to be able to go and test every single water and give you a level on everything. It's just not practical.
But I'd like to know which ones are exceptionally good for low mercury.
Okay. Just as a general rule for you, I would give you some information. The higher you go up in a drainage, most typically, you're going to have more of a nutrient poor system. You're going to have less contaminants, if you want to call them that. It's cleaner water. You'll have less mercury and stuff. That's not always the case, but as a general rule. So if you want to go to the Uintas, up high in a high lake, and fish there, you'll have less contaminants by way of mercury in those kind of waters. Does that make sense? So that would just be a general rule of thumb that you could maybe use.
In specific water, I like, for example, I like Vanderbilt best water. I haven't been able to find any
information. Uh-huh.
I might mention that the Division of Wildlife Resources assists the Department of Health in, we collect the samples. They're the ones that actually run the samples. They're the ones that issue the health advisories. I would suggest that you talk with the folks from the Department of Health or the Division of Water Quality to get that full list of all the waters that have been sampled and what the results are from all the waters that have been sampled thus far in the state of Utah. We're really the technicians on this project. We collect the fish. They're the ones that do stuff with them. So, and they're the ones that publish the results.
So, Randy, keep in mind it's fishadvisories.utah.gov. That would be a source for you. fishadvisories.utah.gov.
Thank you, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
You doing the Schofield one?
No. I think Paul's going to do that one for us.
Invite Paul the microphone.
I'm going to, first of all, try and climb. Can you help me out, Scott? I can't see all your icons through this lovely picture.
Okay, regulation. Is that it right here? Is it a Word document or
no,
a PowerPoint?
No, it's this one.
Rules 1 and 2.
Prior to my coming to Salt Lake a little over a year ago, year and a half ago, I was the regional aquatics manager in Price and very familiar with Schofield Reservoir. The person that succeeded me, Justin Hart, was unable to make it tonight, so he asked me to present this. I'm going to make this as quick as I possibly can. One of the reasons why we wanted to talk to you about Schofield, though, is that first of all, it's an important water. It typically ranks out in the top five in terms of our flatwater fisheries in the state. 70% or more of the anglers that visit Schofield during the course of the year come from the central region. So these are a couple of my babies that were put in there. So we recently had the fourth state record tiger trout caught out of Schofield in the last year and a half. It was 19 pounds, 2 ounces, I believe. And according to Don Wiley, who actually got to see the fish, the guy spent, it was over 24 hours after he caught it before he had it officially weighed, and the likelihood was that it was actually a world record. So in the next, my personal prediction is in the next 12 months, we will see a world record tiger trout of over 21 pounds, 13 ounces caught out of Schofield Reservoir, hopefully on the end of my line. Okay, real quickly, 2005, the division discovered Utah chubs back in the reservoir during our spring sampling. That fall, we stocked tiger trout to try and get ahead of the chubs then and to control their numbers. We added Bear Lake cutthroat trout as an additional predator in 2009, and yes, this is a pile of Utah chubs in that picture. You can see what the chub numbers have done in the reservoir since 2005. 2005, very low. 2006, very low. We were starting to get hopeful that by stocking the tiger trout, we had gotten ahead of the curve there, and we were going to be able to control them. Unfortunately, chubs are very fecund. And in 2007, their numbers start to come up. 2008, they really started to increase more. 2009, they peaked. We started stocking Bear Lake cutthroat trout. Since then, we've seen a reduction in their numbers. 2010, that low number there is probably an anomaly because of weather. But we did go from about 350 fish per net night. That is, every time we set a gill net in there, 2009, every net that we pulled out had about 350 chubs in it, down to 150 chubs that we're seeing these days. Rainbow trout, on the other hand, are very affected by the presence of Utah chubs, and we've seen a reduction in the condition of the fish first through 2010, and then 2008, their condition factor really started to decline, and by 2013, they were almost completely eliminated from the fishery. Not only their condition is bad, but their survival has really gone down. So beginning in 2011, we contracted with Utah State University to look at whether biological control of Utah chubs is possible using Salmonid predators. And this is a huge question for us because we spent almost $4 million treating Strawberry Reservoir in 1990. We need to know whether we have other options here. So the reservoir Schofield study had four major objectives. How does the food web operate? What is the size and condition of the predator population in the reservoir? What are the preferred prey species, degree of diet overlap? And number four is the $64,000 question here, or my estimate of treatment costs. It's really the $1 million question to if we had to treat Schofield Reservoir. Can the predator population limit the prey population through top-down control? And five, are the three predators limited by interspecific competition? We'll really just focus on number four here. Can the predator population limit the prey population through top-down control? So one of the ways we determine how many predators or how many trout we had in the reservoirs, we did hydroacoustic sampling in August of 2011 and June of 2013. This is essentially a very expensive, very fancy sonar. Drive it around the lake, dark of the moon. It integrates the number of hits that it gets, and based on the size of the hit, it can distinguish size of the fish. And then using gill nets, et cetera, we then partition those numbers out into whether it's a chub, a trout, rainbow trout, cutthroat trout, or a tiger trout. So the estimate of fish in the reservoir in the small size class that is less than 350 millimeters, and which is approximately 15 inches, and then the large, which is over 350 millimeters, you can see that cutthroat trout have done very well, and part of that is because we stock them at 8 inches. They're kind of past that competitive problem where you have interaction between the chubs and the trout, so they can they do very well there. So, how many prey are they eating then If you look at the population size, which is the same figure from the previous graph, you have about 81,000 small cutthroat trout. They are estimated to eat 251,000 chubs. The large cutthroat trout, almost 338,000 of them, are estimated to eat 16.7 million chubs. Rainbow trout make no significant contribution to the predation of chubs, which is not unexpected. They're not known for being particularly piscivorous, and there's not very many of them in the reservoir to begin with. The tiger trout, their numbers are not as high as the cutthroat trout, but on an individual basis, a large tiger trout eats more chubs than a large cutthroat trout. So you'll see what the recommendation is here in a minute. Grand total is that they estimate that they eat about 26 million chubs a year. Now, that number, these are very preliminary data. I pushed the university hard to get me some report so that we could come out to the racks. They're going to be massaging this information, and I would not be surprised to see that 26 million number cut in half based on some information that they didn't have time to put into this particular version of it. But nonetheless, they eat a lot. I think that's the take-home message here, is that the cutthroat trout, the Bear Lake cutthroat trout, and the tiger trout eat a grundle of chubs on an annual basis. So right now what we're saying is prey consumption appears to be greater than the estimated annual chub production. Utah chubs, great. This is where it gets tough, though, is that Utah chubs greater than 200 millimeters, that is 8 inches, are much less susceptible to predation and simultaneously are the most prolific in terms of producing young. Thus, it will take time for large chubs to completely disappear from the reservoir, and we need to maintain the predation pressure during that whole period of time. Work that we did at Joes Valley back in 2005 through 2007, and a female Utah chub, single female Utah chub, produces about 11,000 eggs. And they can live over 20 years. So you have a very long period of time where these female chubs are going to be pumping out a lot of eggs. So management recommendations from the university study are rainbow trout are providing very little return to the sport fishery. They're providing limited predation, whereas tiger trout and cutthroat trout are consuming millions of Utah chub. From this, we've decided to cease the rainbow trout stocking. What that will do for us is provide us the opportunity, both within the reservoir production, a space in the reservoir, and also space in our hatchery system, to switch from producing rainbow trout, currently 80,000 7-inch fish, to producing more cutthroat trout to go in there. We also likely will increase our tiger trout stocking. There's an upper limit there that we're still trying to tease out to figure out what that number is, but the university recommends at 320,000 trout, 75% tiger trout, and 25% cutthroat trout. We will have to tweak that based on, you know, reanalysis of the information plus what the public wants. But this is the question that we had on the survey. So it was that the rainbow trout are experiencing increasingly poor returns, and are we better off with more predators? This year we asked if anglers would support ceasing rainbow trout stocking 3 to 5 years, and maybe longer than that. The actual question was that there was some background information, and we said, do you support a 3 to 5 year suspension of rainbow trout stocking? and increased stocking of Bear Lake cutthroat trout at Schofield. This was a critical question for us because most of the people in the state of Utah that buy a fishing license do so for the opportunity to catch rainbow trout. That is the most sought after species in the state. In 2005, just, you know, 8 short years ago, the only fish that you could catch at Schofield Reservoir was a rainbow trout. We wanted to know what the public's opinion was going to be, if they just wanted rainbow or if they were willing to accept this other species suite. Surprisingly, 90% of the respondents were in favor of the change. We're only contemplating this change if the results from the USU study indicate the biological control can work. That appears to be the case. So we're going to move forward with that into the future. So just a quick timeline. We set this timeline into place in 2009, just so that we had some talking points with the public. It also kept us on track for our planning. We discovered the chubs in 2005, 2009, cutthroat trout were stocked. 2010, we did some preliminary planning for the USU study. 2011, we implemented that or initiated that study. 2013, where we're at right now, we've started planning for a rotenone treatment if it becomes necessary, which hopefully it's not going to be. Our original idea was that in 2014 or 15, if necessary, we would move forward with a rotenone treatment and increase predator stocking. And in 2015, we're planning a creel survey. The money's already programmed in. There's a website here that gives some more information if you're interested. It's a blog that I wrote a couple of years ago. So that's it in a nutshell. Do we have any questions from either the RACs or the RAC or the public? I'd be happy to answer them. Yes, Danny.
So it seems that you could have your cake and eat it too. A compromise on the rainbow situation might be a token stocking of larger, obviously expensive rainbow trout, and then that would be a novelty in the lake, and would that negatively affect us?
It may not negatively affect us, other than, you know, as well as I do, that there's only so many dollars to drive this, plus there's only so much space in the reservoir, so much, you know, are we getting to some kind of carrying capacity, basically. If we completely replace the 80,000 rainbow trout that we're stocking right now with 80,000 Bear Lake cutthroat, which is what we're talking about, is there still room for another 20,000 or 30,000 or whatever that number is of 10-inch rainbow? And will they return enough to make the price worth it? I don't know the answer to that.
And I guess, the inference is that the rainbows are not competing with these other predators. And so,
and with the chubs primarily,
may not be that significant, and they tend to partition themselves anyway, right?
Yeah, it looks like we have inshore and offshore partitioning between the different trout species. The biggest problem with rainbow is that they have almost a 100% diet overlap with the chubs. We didn't show it here, but we did do stable isotope analysis of the 4 major species in the reservoir, and the rainbow trout and the Utah chubs line up just like this.
So wouldn't that result in a lower condition factor of probably both, but the Utah chubs allowing predation to be even more effective?
We don't typically calculate condition factors of chubs. I don't know. I can tell you it was impacting the rainbow condition.
Is there a slot restriction on tiger trout in Schofield?
There is. It's a 15 to 22 inch, two fish under 15, one over.
So basically, you're going to have two fish in that reservoir that have restrictions, slot limits, right? And you're taking all the rainbows out that don't have them.
That's correct.
So does that concern you about people not using that fishery for that reason alone?
We had that concern. That's why we've persisted in stocking rainbow. The rainbow are only returning 2 to 3% right now of the fishery. People that fish Schofield at the moment are not fishing it for rainbow trout. They are fishing it for the opportunity to catch a world record tiger trout or a trophy cutthroat trout. Those cutthroat trout have only been in there since 2009. We are producing some 7-pound cutthroat trout out of there right now. It is a fish growing machine. So I don't think we're going to see a significant impact from that. I really anticipated the public coming back and saying that we want rainbow in there. They said, we're fine. Do what you got to do. Yes, sir.
So the hope is you don't have to do the treatment. You did have to do that. Not very selective killers.
No, it will take every fish out of there. What? That is the downside to producing huge fish. And I actually, as a manager in 2005, said, roll up the rotenone right now. Let's do it right this second. I can turn this fishery around in a weekend if I had to. But I didn't have to pay the bill. So that was the chief's decision to not pay that, and maybe the right one. If we decided to do it right now, it would be an uphill battle to implement that.
Well, wouldn't it make sense to introduce flies and lures only at Schofield and turn it into an incredible trophy fishery that would draw people from all over the country to fish it?
That is certainly one of the things that we've been talking about is what is the long-term management of Schofield and what do we want it to look like? Mike talked about a management plan for Hubert Reservoir. The guys in the southeast region are under direction right now to start to ask those questions, to develop a management plan for Schofield. Schofield has traditionally, as you're aware, Schofield has traditionally been the place that, especially since 1990 when we redid the strawberry fishery, that if you had a boatload of kids, you loaded up the wagon and hauled them over to Schofield because that's where they could fish with pretty much anything for everything that they could catch. And it's been a paradigm shift and really kind of happened quickly and somewhat unexpectedly there at Schofield. It may be time to take Schofield to the next level, but it's really going to be driven by what does the public want.
You guys who are talking from the audience, will you please come to the mic?
We are taping this and we're recording it, and the person that has to write all this up is going to be straining her ears to pick it up. Just a quickie, has there been any thought of Tiger Muskie? Okay, your comment won't be, your comment won't be registered.
You have to come up here. Sorry. I'd be happy to answer that question.
Yeah, my name's Robin Spicer. I love the Tiger Muskie. Have you ever thought of putting those in Schofield?
I got to back up just a second.
I put them everywhere if it was me.
Okay, I got to back up for just a second.
They need the cutthroats.
We had a chub problem in Joe's Valley. We considered a bunch of different options there. In fact, that 2005 to 2007, we thought we could net them out of there. We removed 40,000 pounds of pre-spawn chub and estimated that 940 million eggs were removed from the system. After a tremendous amount of effort, we made absolutely no difference in the chub population. So we decided to look at a biological control. We settled on tiger muskie. Joes Valley sits in the San Rafael drainage, which feeds into the Green River, which is home to four endangered species of fish and innumerable native fish. We have an interstate compact with states of Colorado and Wyoming and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that we will not stock a non-native warm water or cool water fish into that system without their approval. We went through that approval process. We had originally intended to stock wipers and tiger muskie into Joes Valley. We were only able to secure permission to stock tiger muskies with the understanding that we would sample every year downstream from the reservoir, and if we detect four tiger muskie in the first mile below the reservoir or two in the section below that or one anywhere in the San Rafael River, that we would discontinue stocking, we would liberalize the limit, and we would attempt to get the tiger muskie back out of there. Okay, and that's with the outlet configuration that we have at Joes Valley, which is not really conducive to fish escaping from that reservoir. Schofield sits in the Price River, feeds into the Green River, home to four endangered fish, innumerable native fish. The outlet structure at Schofield absolutely would allow those fish to escape from the reservoir. In 2011, when the reservoir was spilling, I stood on that bridge over the spillway, and I could not count how many fish were going over that spillway. They were going over so quickly. We would wind up with tiger muskie down in Green River, and we simply would not be able to do that for those. Which was a long answer, but...
Too bad, Robin.
You got it.
It's too hard to manage fish.
Yeah.
I can just ask one more time. You may have answered in his question, and I missed it. But with the slot limit similar to strawberry, currently do you have any numbers? Are you losing fishermen on that, or is it staying stable?
We have not done... We did... creel surveys in 1987, 1998, 2005, 2008, and we have another one scheduled for 2015, as I mentioned. In 1987, we had 347,000 hours of pressure at Schofield Reservoir. By 1998, that had declined to about 260,000 hours. By 2005, prior to the any change in the regulation, it had decreased to about 114,000. In 2008, it declined further to about 104,000. Now, what the reason for the decline was between 1987 and 1998 is not clear. The regulation was exactly the same. The fishery, the stocking was exactly the same. Catch per unit effort on the gill nets was exactly the same. Everything was the same. For whatever reason, that no longer became an attractive fishery, and it decreased in popularity. In 2005, when we did the survey again, we were concerned about the declining pressure there. You may recall that in 2008, we increased the limit to eight fish to try and attract people back to that fishery. Yet, in fact, what we saw was that there was a decline in use and a decline in harvest between the 2005 and 2008 survey. 2008 happened to be a year, and it happened to be the year that I bought my pickup truck that gets 16 miles to the gallon, that gas prices in Carbon County went to $4.50 a gallon. That same year, not only did we see a decrease in the use at Schofield, we saw a dramatic shift in the composition of the use. I mentioned that prior to that, 70 to 75% of the anglers came from this side of the hill. In 2008, about 60% of the anglers came from the Carbon County side of the hill. People that lived over here did not make the trip up to Schofield. And we then changed the regulation to a slot limit in 2009. If anything, it will be my suspicion, Brad, that in 2015, when we do the creel survey again, we will actually see an increase in use just because of that trophy aspect of the fishery that's being offered there that was not previously available.
Okay. Very thorough answer.
All right, that's my middle name. Paul Thorough Answer Birdsey. I have very strange parents.
We appreciate your time, Paul. Appreciate you being here with us and presenting this information and helping everybody understand what's going on. Seeing no further business, we'll adjourn this meeting.